Tonight on The Download, Chicago artist Kerry James Marshall, iconic jazz pop musician Herb Alpert, and from the new web series Low Strung, Victoria Lee and Shervin Bain. Now, here's your host, a man who wishes he had a few bucks lying around to buy a news site, Justin Kaufman.
Seriously, huh? A DNA info story, it hurts, man. I don't like that at all. It kind of feel like the, the gloom and doom. A lot of friends, a lot of people who spent a big chunk of their career, great writers and talented journalists. Some people you've heard on the air here on this show, WGN, that are out of work because the business wasn't profitable. Not good. But I always enjoy, I want to say this, it's not good and it's a terrible story. But I will say DNA Info Chicago and Chicagoist were doing some great work. Be proud of the work they did for Chicago. I was impressed that DNA Info became a mainstay. It went past the idea of, oh, this is fun, a different site. Oh, they're doing news too. To a part of everyday, media diet. I mean, everybody. I mean, how many times, look at the site and talk about what's happening in certain neighborhoods. It's great. It's going to be missed. Chicagoists as well. I've always loved that site. They've always been great. And it's a sad day that those sites are no longer in the city of Chicago. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up. We're going to talk about that. Talk about DNA in Chicago. Scott Smith, our new media contributor, is going to join us later in the program. We'll talk about why this happened, what it means for Chicago's media landscape. And is the system just broken? Is the economic system broken? Is it time to really take a hard look at what it means to be a profitable business in the media landscape? And whether or not anyone is going to come in and fill that void? Are we starting to see more of the billionaires and trillionaires and the businessmen, the entrepreneurs saying, that's just not a good business to be in? Have we seen the last of hyper-local programs and projects and newspapers and sites? We'll talk with Scott about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Tonight, Kerry James Marshall is going to join us, great Chicago artist. I mean, one of the best. He's going to be my guest at the big table. We'll talk about, I don't know if you've been able to walk downtown past Cultural Center. They are in the midst of building a huge mural on the side of the building. It's beautiful. Kerry James Marshall is the artist. He's putting together, I think it's his first public display like this. And of course, Kerry James Marshall has been known around the world, including here at the Art Institute and the Museum of Contemporary Art, as one of the most renowned Chicago artists. We'll talk with the Bronzeville resident coming up here at the big table in the 8 o'clock hour. 9 o'clock hour, Herb Alpert. Herb Alpert's coming to the City Winery coming up here in next week. And it's amazing to me that he outsold the Beatles. Not too many artists that come on our show that have that in their resume. Herb Alpert, Tijuana Brass, that record and the records he put out in the 60s, they were constantly outselling. And I'm not talking early Beatles. We're like, who are these mop tops from Liverpool? No, this was like when they were in their heyday doing Can't Buy Me Love, or even it's mid-60s. When the Beatles were the Beatles, they lost out to Herb Alpert, the longtime producer, musician, record executive. We have my guest coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight. How great is that, huh? Also, new web series, Low Strung. Victoria Lee, Shervin Bain will be here. We'll talk about that. A show that is chock full of Chicago, as well as Chicago music. So we'll talk about that. And also coming up, we will talk to Which Rich Women Rock. They'll be my guest in the Download of Chicago Business. We'll talk about female empowerment when it comes to finances. And we'll talk a little tax reform. How about that? News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier, Esmeralda Liam. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, so Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All All right, here are today's top stories. If you visit a DNA Info site this afternoon, you're greeted with a letter from owner Joe Ricketts explaining why he shut down the hyperlocal site and Gothamist, the parent company from the great Chicagoist here in Chicago. In the letter, Ricketts says he loves local journalism, and this decision was made in part because of the New York staff's vote to unionize last week. To Ricketts' credit, there's at least some severance for the 100-plus journalists that lost their jobs today. It's a sucky story for them and for us who lost not one but two local news sources, and worst, all of its archives. If servers cost money, so the DNA Info in Chicago is just like they just never existed, which is a huge slap in the face to the hundreds, if not thousands, of talented writers who've worked for this company. Although due to pressure, it looks like Ricketts is going to come through on the issue of the archive. But what does all of it mean? It means that you'll have to get your neighborhood news from somewhere else, and that landscape is shrinking, and more news shops decide to cut and eliminate local coverage. So in other words, you like journalism that analyzes Trump tweets? You're fine then. Nothing's going to change. But if you want something more. And frankly, if the company was so shaky to begin with that a unionized workforce forced the hand of the owner who loves local journalism so much, then what was he paying the writers in the first place? Yeah, you mean I can't just pay these guys a quota? Yeah. Anyway, well, I, for one, am going to stop supporting any Ricketts-owned companies in Chicago. Are we all in agreement on that? Anybody? No. In Washington, House Republicans unveiled a tax plan. Highlights, mega rich get a cut. Mini rich pay more. Everyone else gets a new flat screen. We good? Did I nail it? I think I nailed it. Actually, this plan isn't all that bad for the American family if you don't make a ton of money and you live in a red state. The big sticking point for Democrats is why what they consider to be a blue state penalty, in which property taxes and mortgage interest deductions are limited. Democrats don't like the Republican bill because, well, that's what Democrats do. But they do call the bill and the process a disgrace and question why we can't hear from experts and what this is going to do for the economy, where's the CBO score, all that kind of jazz. They also say Republicans are favoring corporate America over the American people. What? That sounds way out of character. Can't be real. But look at it this way. The way capitalism favors the rich is that you go and start your own business, right? And most business people will tell you that the more successful you get, the more money government wants in taxes. Trump fixes that by bringing the corporate tax rate down permanently so that companies will grow and grow to be mega companies, mega corporations, and will not have to go set up shop in overseas because, well, America will have some of the lowest taxes in the world. So, yes, you get to keep your business here, but the argument is that they don't really end up paying their fair share. And their little stunt of going overseas to avoid being taxed worked. So, to me, we fix one problem to create another, which is classic Congress. So, yeah, I say go for it. Twitter's abuzz with some stuff that I'm way too lazy to fact check, but student loan deductions are on the table, medical deductions are out, and according to the Democratic senator from Oregon, the corporations will get to write off state and local property taxes while the people won't. That can't be. Tell me that can't be. Please tell me that won't be. No, that's a better question. This is the biggest change of tax policy in decades, and Republicans don't care about getting it right since they've already said they want to get it to the president's desk by the holidays. Because there's nothing that screams, yeah, we fixed the biggest problem in our country, than trying to get the job done as fast as you possibly can. I mean, the fifth grade teacher can tell you that that's probably a bad idea. There's a big difference between 7 out of 10 and 8 out of 10. It's a B or a C, right? But I'm reserving judgment till I talk to my tax accountant, which will be on April 13th, when I bring in a bunch of random papers and hand it to her like a toddler. Do something with this. But when she says, did you give any money to charity? I can say, does fantasy baseball count as charity? Because, yeah, then I'm going to get a refund. In Springfield, Chicago State Senator Ira Silverstein resigned his leadership post after allegations of sexual harassment. He was working with a lobbyist for a bill, and she says once he realized she had a boyfriend, he killed the bill. Also, she released the Facebook messages to the Sun-Times that talked a lot about ice cream and exercise. Yeah. Silverstein didn't resign his seat, just the leadership role, which will be a pay cut. It also was revealed that there's no HR in Springfield, which is kind of obvious because HR would probably have written up the governor for dressing like he did in that Harley campaign video, right? You can't wear that vest. That's right. That's a pink. It's one check. In weather today, gloomy. Perfect weather for nothing. In sports today, social media went out of their way to remind us it's a one-year anniversary of the Cubs winning the World Series. Although, I thought they won the game on November 3rd, right? I mean, it was a late game. But I guess we get 48 hours to enjoy that win. The Hawks got back to their winning ways by shutting out the Flyers yesterday. Good. The Bulls, on the other hand, played fast and loose last night, lost in Miami. Lauri Markkanen continues to produce 25 points. And the Bears are on a bye week. Terrible news today. Texans fear that standout rookie Deshaun Watson tore his ACL in practice. And this is why I don't practice, people. This is why I just play on Sunday. And finally tonight, the owner of Papa John's, Papa John, is that his name? is saying that the NFL protests are hurting his pizza business. Really? Because I'd say that garlic Parmesan dipping sauce is what's hurting business. I mean, too much. Too fat. Too bad. No. That's the carryout for November 2nd, 2017. It's cold, it's rainy, so we are quadruple bagging tonight. You'll thank us later when you need an extra plastic bag to throw away the leftovers. All right, coming up, the download on Chicago business, and Kerry James Marshall is going to join us at the big table tonight. A little bit later on, Herb Alpert, great jazz pop musician. It's a download here at 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Not too bad, my friend, echoing what you said earlier about DNA info. That was a bit of a disappointment this afternoon.
You know, we're going to talk a little later. Scott's going to be on, and we'll talk about what it means, because that's, it's a tough loss.
Well, you know, the saying, all politics is local, and you start stripping away the local coverage, then who's watching these local politicians and what's going on in our communities?
You and I, Rob.
I'm with you, man.
It's just, we're the ones that are left.
I'm doing my best.
Yeah.
It's business time.
Thanks, Rob. It is time for the Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our weekly segment that features entrepreneurs and CEOs and principals, in this case, who tell their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, we talk about the big business of wealth management. Financial advisors have become as important as family in some cases, as they are tasked with managing your money, especially as you build wealth and prepare yourself for life after work. My guest tonight is the owner and principal of Stonebridge Wealth Advisors, Annette Findling. But what makes Annette unique is that she's focusing primarily on women. Her blog is called Rich Women Rock, and it's designed to help women make healthy and smart and maintainable choices about their financial future. Chicago Woman Magazine named Annette in their Fierce 50 edition. She's celebrating 25 years of doing this work. Annette Findley, the principal at Stonebridge Wealth Advisors. Welcome to the Download in Chicago
Thank
Business.
Thank you, Justin, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about, I mean, first off, before we get into Rich Women Rock, how did you get into the business of wealth management, being an advisor?
Well, 25 years ago, I was I had some friends in the business, and I love numbers, and I love helping people. So by observation, I was in my mid to late 20s and trying to figure out what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I thought, by observing my friends, I thought, well, that looks like a great business to get into. And I, looking back at it today, I never realized how much fun it really would be. So,
is it fun? It's a fun job?
It is a really fun job.
I would think it would not be fun. I would think that the stress around people's money and investment would, I don't know if I'm built for that.
Well, everybody's wired in a different way. So,
at what point, I mean, because when you started your business, it was not necessarily focused expressly for women. There was this idea,
right.
It was for everybody, still is, but the idea of focusing on women with Rich Women Rock, that came later. How did that come about?
Okay, well, 25 years ago, when I started, my office was right here across the parkway on 401 North Michigan. I looked around the office, and there were no other women advisors. So I was one of the very few, and the manager that hired me said, well, we'll find somebody, because I said, are there any other women here? But that was okay. I could play in the man's sandbox as well. And I kind of... So when I started my career, 4 years into it, there was another gentleman that was old enough to be my dad, quite frankly, and his wife became sick, and he was looking for a successor to his business, and he had been in the business for 40 years. So he had a really, really nice clientele. And he interviewed me and two other guys in the office. His wife, Mary, was just great, and she said, you should think about working with Annette. And he thought, a woman? And so Joe and I are still great friends, and so he chose me as his successor. We became partners, and while I was still learning to build my business, I learned from him. He was not only a great mentor, but I got to learn his clients. And the reason I'm telling you that is because his clients were so much older. And shortly after into our relationship, I started having the experience of working with a widow, you know, losing a spouse. And, you know, that generation was more traditional, where maybe she stayed home, the husband worked, and she wasn't involved in the money. And so I have a very specific story in my brain that one of the men that called me to his home, he was on an oxygen tank, and said, I need to speak to you, and need you to take care of my wife because I feel like the end is coming near. And that was really an eye-opening, life-changing experience for me, because here I am responsible for helping her when that day comes. And I said, well, I've never met her, so can she be a part of these meetings? And he said, she does not want to deal with money. She won't address it. She's just off with her friends. And I thought, all right. So shortly after, he passed away, and there I am sitting at a table, at their dining room table, with mounds of paper, and she has no idea where everything is. So going through drawers and piecemealing everything together, and I thought, so after that experience, I had other experiences, whether it's losing a spouse or a woman going through a divorce and just being stunned and grieving, and the additional financial stress one has, I thought could have been eliminated if you could have learned a little bit more about
in your work in the 25 years, you see in different, like you just said, if someone someone's getting divorced or maybe they're widowed, but this idea that and it mostly particularly is with women, that this idea that this doesn't apply to me. I don't want to deal with money right now. Where does that come from? Is that a generational thing? Are you seeing that sort of wipe away as we get to a new generation or the younger kids that are coming up now?
I'm seeing women taking a greater role or interest in it, for sure. And I think, our industry doesn't always communicate to women in a way that makes them feel confident. And I think that's the missing link.
Yeah.
So it's intimidating, and people talk in financial jargon, and they don't understand it. And, no one wants to feel, uncomfortable. But I am starting to see really young people, and this is really refreshing. We do 401k plans for some PR firms here in the city. And, we're talking to people that are 21, 23 years old, and these young people are coming to talk to me about their 401k allocations. And it's interesting because they're starting to take a role, an interest in learning, because they've seen their parents and grandparents suffer financial hardship.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back. Annette Findlay is the owner and principal of Stonebridge Wealth Advisor and also the author of the blog Rich Women Rock. She has taken on the unique idea of focusing primarily on women when it comes to financial planning and financial advice. We'll take a quick break. We come back. I want to talk about the challenges of doing that as you grow a business and you determine that that's going to be an area that you want to particularly focus on. But then also the challenge of dealing with the emotion that comes with money. Annette Findlay, my guest tonight. Stay with us.
It's business time. It's business.
It's Download Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. In studio, Annette Findling. She is the owner and principal of Stonebridge Wealth Advisors. We're talking about not only her business and 25 years in Chicago, advising people on their financial well-being, but also what her blog. She's the author of Rich Women Rock, which is designated to help or designed to help women make healthy, smart, and maintainable choices about their financial future. You know, the emotional part of this, and I'm always intrigued by the work of being an advisor, because you have to be able to talk to the clients who may come in at this day and age with a much more sophistication than they did 20, 25 years ago. People are coming in now are like you just mentioned, the 23-year-olds, 21. They know what they want. They know what they're looking for. They may even have a certain style in which they want to invest their money. How does that change your business? How does that change the way you approach your clients and maintain your business when there's just so much education circling around this industry?
Right. Well, that's true. There is more information, more financial products, more data swirling around more than ever. I mean, you turn on your phone, it's in the elevator, it's on your TV screen. We're all, as a consumer, it's everywhere. So what we do is, what's really important is really understanding what the clients, where they want to go with their life, and having a meaningful discussion on what makes their life, quote unquote, rich. And then it's taking all that data and boiling it down to what's going to be the right fit for them. So oftentimes we will get questions. Here's an example. Client says, hey, my buddy and I was at a cocktail party, and he's getting this great return on this investment. And, you know, it sounded too good to be true, quite frankly. And knowing the client's comfort for risk and what his lifestyle is, mm-hmm. I said, well, great, let me look into it. So I looked into it, and I said, oh, my gosh, this thing is, it's not sustainable. It's so high risk. You know, this isn't going to fit. Oh, okay, you're right. That's not what I want. So we get a lot of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you also have to match with what I would assume could also be an uneducated customer who comes in and says, I'm a big gambler. I like to invest. I like this. This is what I want. I want $1 trillion, right? Make this happen. Do you have to walk people off of that? Do you have to when you're working with them to say, this is how this works, you know, what you have in your mind is different than the actual reality?
Oh, for sure. We're not day traders. If you want to day trade, then do your E-Trade account. Yeah, I mean, it's getting people to bring them back to what's reality. Again, you tell me how you want your life to look, and I like to call it the movie of your life. And what's interesting is a lot of people don't think past tomorrow or next week. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about get people to think about being financially independent. I hate using the word retirement. So when you start talking about what you want to accomplish in your life and what you want the story of your life to look like, then the financial products are simply the tools to help you get there.
Right.
So it takes away from this whole, you know, wild west of...
Well, your industry is no different than the other industries out there when you talk about the way that technology has changed it.
Right.
You kind of mentioned, you know, people having more sophistication, but there's even commercials that we see during football games or what have you that are essentially saying you don't need a financial planner.
Right.
You don't need advice. Here is the tool. You can do it on your phone. You can take control of your own situation. Do you feel can you notice a change and a trend in Americans that are looking beyond or past the financial advisor and just determining to do this stuff on their own?
What kind of pressure does
But
technology is our friend, but it also adds. So in times when the markets are good, people can say, well, great, I could probably do this myself and get the same return. But it's when times are not so good, then they want to talk to a human. And when you've got more of a complicated situation, and it's not just about investments, it's about do I have the right amount of insurance? What do I have my wills in place? It's we help coordinate all of those different things to, you know, in their whole holistic plan. So technology, there is a time and a place for it, and we embrace technology in our practice. We because people are busier than ever. They're traveling on airplanes. And I noticed recently that a lot of my clients don't even live nearby anymore. They live in other states because they retired, moved where their kids are moving, or job transfers.
Right.
So we're using technology in a way that we can collaborate quickly with people, and we don't have to worry about paper exchanges. We can use our web portals, et cetera, and FaceTiming meetings and WebExes, to whether they're sitting across the, you know, the table from me or they're 2,000 miles away.
I always think about it because I'll have a lot of people in who have their own business, and they'll talk about how important it is, what are the things that they see to be the key to their business. And they'll always say people, people, people.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, it's a much more customer service-based job, or at least industry, in the way that the people that you rely on are your clients. And talk about that relationship, because it is, to me, one of those where – yes, it can be family in a pro and a con kind of situation that people move around. How do you have to develop yourself and your personality to be a people person, to continue to evolve with your clients, to be the right kind of voice when it comes to helping manage their finances?
Oh, sure. You know, the people can buy products and services from everywhere, but it's the ability to connect one-on-one and have a meaningful conversation with a couple, a single person, a whole family. We've had family meetings to educate children about their elderly parents' finances. So that people still want to talk to people. And I, you know, there is a time and a place for technology and the internet to do your management. And we saw this in the 90s. If you recall, you know, the tech bubble, right?
Yeah, right?
Everybody, a lot of people were taking, well, I can just buy stocks and mutual funds on E-Trade and it's all going up. Well, sure, that's great. But when it
comes back down,
when
right?
it goes back down, it's like, okay, then let's talk to an advisor. So we're part therapist too.
You know, you've spent 25 years in Chicago, and you just mentioned a lot of your clients are now moving around different places. But what is it? Why here? Why Chicago? What was it about setting up shop and the clients that you have here in the area that makes this unique and helps you do your work?
Well, I love, my husband and I, we love the city of Chicago. And we recently moved back to the city. We raised our kids in the suburbs. And it's just, it's so vibrant. And what I love coming to work every day, our offices are at Michigan and Oak Street. I feel like I'm Mary Tyler Moore and that girl. And just, there's just such a great energy. And there's nothing better than walking down Michigan Avenue and meeting people.
My last question, just to make it topical, is just about, you know, today on Capitol Hill, a Republican congressman introduced a bill to change the tax code in America. As a financial advisor and someone where you see a lot of these words, buzzwords getting thrown around from deductions and interest and retirement savings, is today a day that you're just getting calls from clients that are saying, what does this mean for me?
Well, we've educated our clients, and today is no different than any other time in the past. There's always something new coming out of Washington, D.C., and, you know, the estate tax has been, there's just always been something. So today isn't any different. And basically, we have to plan for the facts that we know today. So what all that they're talking about is
right.
just until it becomes reality. And so that's why when you have a financial plan, it's got to be fluid and flexible to meet all these different changes. So
Annette Findling is the owner and principal of Stonebridge Wealth Advisor. She's also the author of the blog Rich Women Rock, which is designed to help women make healthy, smart, maintainable choices about their future. And she's my guest tonight on The Download in Chicago Business. Annette, great to meet you. Thanks
Thank
so much for being
so
my guest.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest at the big table is one of Chicago's best artists, Kerry James Marshall. Was just honored by the city with a 5th Star award, and he's been commissioned to create a 132-foot mural for the Year of Public Art. It'll be the largest work he's ever designed or created, and it will honor 20 women who have had an impact on the city's arts and culture scene.
Kerry James Marshall grew up in L.A., but you would never know that because the artist has made such an impact with his work right here in Chicago, whether it be at the MCA, the Art Institute, teaching at UIC. Marshall's work is usually large scale and focuses on African-American history and black identity in this country. But to be more specific, Marshall's been driven by the mission to have more racial representation in galleries across the world, telling the stories of the black experience. Last year, he had a great exhibit at the MCA called Mastery, which featured his work from the past 35 years. Kerry James Marshall is one of the best artists working in America today, and he is my guest at the big table. Kerry James Marshall, welcome to The Download.
Well, thank you, Justin.
It's a pleasure to meet you. I've been a big fan of your work for a long time. The 132 foot by what? By 100? This is the largest work you've ever created.
Well, I mean, the size of the work itself is not what makes it such a challenge. I mean, the challenge is not in terms of scale, because anything can be scaled up to just about any size.
Right.
The challenge is actually to make a work that functions really well on the site that the work is designated for. And so where it's going to be on Griffin Court, on the Cultural Center building, the challenge that the shape of that building is a really difficult thing to design something something that would work really well.
How do you prepare for that as an artist? You go scope out the space, taking out your ruler? Like, how do you
well,
prepare?
I wish. Yeah, I mean, 130 feet. Yeah, right. I mean, you kind of can't put a ruler on that, really. But so,
it's a big ruler.
Well, the thing is that you have to work with the architectural drawing. You have to work with the plan. I mean, you're working within a shape, you know, with some very specific features that are interruptions of a picture. Because none of the surfaces are contiguous surfaces, right. So that makes it really hard to do. And it's also right over the loading dock, which means there's a huge cutout sort of in the building too. So working from an architectural drawing of the building, I sort of work within the space that's available and try to figure out what I thought would work really well on that wall, and then from there, what I thought was worth making a picture about.
When you're designing a mural like this, a piece of public art, does the city come to you and say, this is where we want it? They present you with where the space is and what they want to do before.
Initially, right.
Did you have misgivings? Were you like, I don't know, this is a strange shape. I don't know if I can
do
this.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think that's interesting about being an artist, I mean, you're sort of always interested in the challenge. I mean, the challenge is, I think, one of the driving motivators for why you would take on one project as opposed to another. I mean, so I agreed to do it before I saw what the site looked like. And then once I had signed on and agreed that it was something I felt like I could do, then I came down to look at it and then start to figure out what I would do on it.
How did you go through that process? I kind of mentioned in the lead the idea that this will honor 20 women who've had an impact in arts and culture. Where does that idea come from? Take us to the process of you've now know the space, what you're going to, now you have to put something on there. Where does this idea come from?
Well, there's an idea called site specificity. You know, and so that, which means you take into account the location the artwork is going to be in. So, I mean, you could do anything you want to do, but the Cultural Center building is an important building in Chicago. It means a lot to the art community in Chicago. It's meant a lot to the history of arts in Chicago. It was the first place, actually, the first exhibition I had when I moved to Chicago was at the Cultural Center.
Wow.
And so taking all that into account, I mean, you look at what the place is, you look at what it represents, and you try to do something that meets the function of that building and what the things that go on in there represent for the city. And I couldn't think of anything that would be more appropriate for the building than to do something that honored people who also contributed to the dynamism of the culture, and the history of Chicago.
To look at the list, a lot of contemporary names on the list, women, friends of mine, people I've known who I'm like, oh, this is amazing. They're going to be inspired, a Kerry James Marshall mural to be on the side of the Cultural Center building. Talk about the idea of coming up with what essentially is a tribute to the 20 women. Talk about just the idea of why these 20 women and what is taking shape.
Well, I mean, there are a couple of ways to think about it. You know, one is, yes, I mean, they are all women. Over time, it's like they're not all contemporary. They're not all living. Some of them are really young. Some of them are just getting started. And so a part of the idea was to not do the obvious, to not put the people who are always selected to be in a mural, to not always put the most famous people there, But to recognize that the work that people who are doing that lay the foundation for things that might happen 10, 15, 20 years from now, that that's also important.
Yeah.
And so a part of what I tried to do was to think of institutions in Chicago that I thought really had a profound impact. And that's across a spectrum. One of the things you'll notice in the mural is that it in this way that it doesn't do the obvious. It's like, well, there are no musicians. There are no people in that area of the performing arts who are always the go-to people when you think about representing culture in the city. And so that range of people, the people who started theaters, the people who started magazines.
And a lot of writers, right?
Writers, the woman who was the founder of Poetry Magazine, somebody who I didn't even know about until I started looking for people how I would do the mural.
Gosh, man, I'm Kerry James Marshall in studio tonight. What a pleasure to have great Chicago artist here who's doing a mural for the Year of Public Art, 132-foot mural that's on the side of the Cultural Center building. All right, let's take a quick break. When I come back, I want to ask more about the research that goes into your art. Generically, just the idea when we think of artists, we think, okay, they're inspired by what's in front of them. They may mess with the discipline or maybe with the paints and the textures. We don't necessarily think about them doing research projects before they start their work. Kerry James Marshall in studio tonight, The Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. My guest at the big table tonight, Kerry James Marshall, the great Chicago artist who has been commissioned to create a 132-foot mural for the Year of Public Art at the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. This is going to be at the Cultural Center on the side of the building. It's a tremendous project that'll be done sometime this fall, winter. Right?
Yeah.
That's the best way to say it. It's being worked on as we speak.
Hopefully before Thanksgiving.
There you go. I mentioned right before the break this idea. I mean, you said, you know, you didn't know some of these names until you started researching them. And it made me think about, you know, as an artist, all the work that you've done over the years, and you've really tried to be, you've really focused on Black identity in this country, but also African-American history. But also, which I love, is just this idea of racial representation. How much research do you put into the work before you actually put it to canvas, put it to the different platforms that you work in?
There are two levels of research. I mean, one is the things that you're always interested in, the things you're already familiar with. And those things you can draw on and you can use that to make work. But when the scope of the work starts to enlarge itself, inevitably it's going to contain things that you're not familiar with, things that you don't know about, and those things you got to find out something about. And so you got to do the research in order to figure out what those things are. And while I was thinking about who I would include in the mural, I did a fair amount of research into the history of Chicago, into the history of various institutions in Chicago, and tried to find out. First, it was important to find out who were the founding members of all those institutions. And where I could select a woman who was a founder, that was the direction I decided I was going to go in. The mural has a kind of a title that's in it, which also gives you some idea of why I chose the direction I went in. So it says Rushmore in there. And it has a double meaning. One is that Rushmore, because it refers to Mount Rushmore, mm-hmm. where you have the representations of four American presidents. But there's a gap in between the Rush and the Moore, which also implies a way in which you should always be moving forward. You should be pushing against. You should always be rushing the, you know, like rush, right. Bum rush the door. Like, and so that also is an aspect of what I wanted the mural to kind of suggest. In doing the research for the women that were going to be in it, these are women who I felt had that kind of impulse.
They bum rushed the door.
They bum rushed the door. I mean, if there was something that wasn't there that they thought needed to be there, they put it there.
I love it.
They made it. As opposed to, you know, sort of going to somebody else and sort of trying to either demand, encourage, right. or beg somebody else to build an institution that was more inclusive. You make an institution that does the things that you want it to do.
Which is very, I so many different interviews that I've done on the program, and a lot of times I'll ask people about what it is about Chicago that they love and what it is about what keeps them here. And a lot of times you'll hear the answers are very similar in the way that they say hustle, or the idea that you can make your own name here, or you can bust through the doors here in Chicago. Chicago has that kind of vibe behind it that you can make a name for yourself and push back against the establishment.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's a great place to do your work. because it's a city full of resources. It's a city full of talent. There are a lot of people who have the drive. And sort of economically, the way the city is situated, it's a place that where it's economically more feasible to launch a lot of things than it might be in some other places. So it's a great place to, I mean, if you're just starting out or if you're somewhere towards the middle of your career, it's a great place it's a great place to anchor yourself and then to really be productive with whatever it is you're trying to do.
When I think about this mural and listening to you and thinking about the work that you've had over your illustrious career, I think about, and this was in the MCA text, the idea of making invisible visible.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of the mission and philosophy of the work that you do. And I think about the idea of these 20 women that you want to focus and highlight and stay away from the famous, famous, famous and try to make these women visible. What is it about that concept that fuels your work? Why that being at the centerpiece of the work that you continue to do?
Well, in a way, I think it just demonstrates that the productive field is always expanding. I mean, that you could settle in and recognize the people who are always recognized, but what you have to acknowledge is that the field is always expanding. I heard a man who wrote a book on the concept of power not too long ago, and he one of the things he said that I think is really important is that you create power out of nothing. That power is sort of an infinite commodity. There's no finite quantity of power. Right. And the same thing is true when it comes to creativity. I mean, there's no finite quantity of creativity. There's creativity being made from nothing all the time. And so I think it's always really important to recognize people who are starting out as well as people who've sort of reached the end of their career, that you acknowledge that, yes, it's a process and that it's a process that's ongoing and that it's always ongoing.
And interpreting that phrase, making invisible visible, I think about the evolution of your work. And you have been an artist. You have been a documentarian through your art. It's startling to look at not only the artistry that you see on display. If you're at the MCA or the Art Institute and you see your work, you're like, wow, this amazing discipline. Everything about it is great. It's a great painting. But there's something great that even in some of the work that you've done in the past, whether it be about Chicago's housing projects mm-hmm. or some of the other topics that you've taken on, it almost becomes a documentary in paint. Do you see it that way?
You could describe it as a documentary in paint, although none of the things that I'm making pictures about have a specific historical event or narrative at their core. They're about a kind of a general concept, a general idea about the presence of or the visibility of certain kinds of things.
The feeling attached to it, right.
Yeah. And so a part of what I try to do with a lot of the work, and when you talk about visibility and invisibility, is that we get used to seeing certain kinds of things, and those things become fixtures of a landscape, or they become fixtures in our imagination. So if you only saw a certain kind of image when you went to the museum, you would expect to see that image every time you went there. And the only way you could change your conception of what belongs in a place like that is to see something that's different. Now, somebody has to provide you with that different thing. And so I made it a part of my mission and the practice to make that thing that was invisible, that thing that you didn't always encounter, to make that thing more commonplace. And the more commonplace those things become, the less extraordinary they become, the more you expect to see them there and the more you believe they belong there.
It's a change agent in a way that you're trying to change the environment and the landscape of what we expect from museums. And I would assume in your illustrious career that you've run into roadblocks where people have said, I don't want to see this in a museum, or this isn't what I expect from this visit. And it has caused some sort of consternation. Have you had pushback to the idea of wanting to change the experience that people are used to or at least brainwashed to in terms of a museum?
And not just in the museum. I mean, yeah, there's always going to be some pushback. I mean, anytime you introduce something that's unfamiliar into the environment, somebody's going to react to it, and sometimes not favorably. Now, people used to react to the fact that the figures that I paint in my painting, I paint using black paint, so they are extremely black. Now, a lot of people have reacted against that kind of blackness because it's unsettling for a lot of people, and for a lot of black people in the United States, blackness had been so stigmatized that even a lot of black people have an aversion to people who have really, really dark skin. And so in a thing like that, that's something that it becomes transformative when you start to look more closely at what's actually happening there. So and you see that the thing that seems to be monotone, single black color is actually much more complex the closer you look, because it's not just one black, it's three basic blacks modified so that you end up with seven different blacks. So what appears to be just one single black color has seven different colors within it. And so then once you start to recognize that on closer examination, a thing is always more complex than it appears to be on its surface, then you start to open up your ideas about what's possible, what's desirable, what's preferable, what you like. I mean, all those things start to change with the experience of having
really
to see something that's more complex.
I
got
to say, once you get to that point where the examination and you have that moment, that epiphany that this is not what it seems. And that's a big
what it first appears to be.
And that's your career. I mean, in the way that you have had a lot of success and people going to see your work and then saying, I got to go back and see that work. And getting pieces at the Art Institute or other places where they're in the collection. And you get a chance to see one of your pieces again and again and again, you start to see different things.
Right. Well, the best response you can have from a spectator to a work of art is that this is not what I expected it to be. That's one of the best responses you could get.
Yeah.
This is more than I thought it was.
Chicago artist Kerry James Marshall is in studio tonight. We were talking about his career, his illustrious career. You can see his work, Art Institute, MCA, all over the galleries all the time. But he has been commissioned to create a 132-foot mural for the Year of Public Art by DK's Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. It's going to be on the side of the Cultural Center building. It should be up before Thanksgiving. We got you on the hook.
They hope.
They hope. Kerry James Marshall, my guest. We'll take a quick break and update on the news, and we'll come back and continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. My guest in studio, Kerry James Marshall, great Chicago artist who has a new mural that's being commissioned by the Department of Cultural Affairs Special Events, 132-foot mural for the Year of Public Art right on the side of the Cultural Center building. It's being worked on now. You can walk by, but it should be done by Thanksgiving time. It's the largest work, Kerry, that you've ever designed or created. It's amazing to think that there can be a first in your career. You know, that's another thing that's like, the largest? Really? I mean, you've done so many different things, and you do work in large scale. There's a lot of different things. I kind of mentioned at the beginning of the interview that, you grew up in L.A., mm-hmm. South Central. You were born in Alabama. Mm-hmm. You came to Chicago, but you would never know that. I think of you as a Chicago artist. We're one of these artists where I'm always like, oh, that's a Chicago-born guy. I can feel Chicago coming out of your work. Talk about how important place has been for your art career.
You can do, as an artist, as a painter in particular, I mean, you can do your work just about anywhere. But I've been in Chicago. It'll be 30 years come this December, 30 years exactly come this December. And when we moved to Chicago, I've been a Southsider ever since I've been here. Mostly in Bronzeville. We lived for a time in Hyde Park, but for most of the time I've been here, I've been in Bronzeville. And for me, the importance of the neighborhood, so the neighborhood that I live in has been the subject of a lot of the work I've done,
mm-hmm.
the neighborhood and the environs around me. Not only is it important because it's a place that I am a part of, but it also gives me an opportunity to demonstrate to people that you can make great things from wherever you are. And so if you live in a neighborhood that has been characterized as hopeless, violent, depressed, impoverished, if you live in a neighborhood that's characterized that way, you can internalize that. And you would internalize that more if every time somebody became successful who lived mm-hmm. in your neighborhood, the first thing they did was get as far away from it as they could.
Right. The mansion on the top of the hill, right?
That means, right, just the people who are left behind then internalize this idea that there's nothing that can be made or done that's worthwhile in this neighborhood. And so a part of what I tried to do with the work that I've made is to demonstrate that you can make remarkable things from wherever you are. Mm. This neighborhood is as stimulating to the imagination as any other can be. And so a good bit of the work that I've made, and a lot of the work that my success has been built on has been built on the fact that I've made, tried to make the places that I've lived in, I've tried to present them as rich and stimulating as any other place could be. So I did a lot. The first group of works I showed at the Art Institute of Chicago was a group of paintings I did called The Garden Project, which were based on housing projects in Chicago, which was two or three blocks from where I lived, that had garden as a part of their name. And so I made a series of pastoral paintings that situated those housing projects in the kind of pastoral setting that the name represents. Mm. And so you don't erase all of the complexities that go along with that, but you can also demonstrate that there's more than just hopelessness in places like this, that you can actually find pleasure, you can find inspiration, you can find a lot of possibility.
As an artist who's always worked to make the invisible visible, but also in the same talk about black identity in this country, being in Chicago and being in Bronzeville, a perfect example of a neighborhood that at one point was a heartbeat of this city, has at one point fallen on hard times. There's been a lot of work to bring it back, and gentrification plays a big role in some of those neighborhoods. But what I mean is that you have been here to watch a city evolve racially. Mm-hmm. It's considered to be one of the most segregated cities in the world. How does that impact your work? Being black and exploring the black identity in this country and being in Chicago, does that have an impact on the work that you produce?
You know, I've been fortunate enough, I guess, to, as a traveler, to have lived in a lot of what people would call the hotbeds of race and conflict in the United States. So, of course, I was born in Birmingham. I grew up in South Central L.A. We moved from Birmingham to Watts. I lived in the Nickerson Garden Projects there, moved into South Central L.A., was in South Central for the riots in 1965. I lived near the Black Panthers headquarters on Central Avenue. 1968, 69, when they had the big shootouts with the LAPD.
Right.
All of that. When I left LA, I moved to New York, but I moved to Harlem. I was on 131st Street near Lenox Avenue. I was right across the street from Liberation Bookstore. So I've always sort of gone to the places
right
where
in the middle of it. Right.
You would be right in the thick of things.
Yeah.
And then came back to Chicago, and where do I end up? I end up on the South Side in Bronzeville. Right near 47th Street, you know, which is the hub of the nightclub, nightlife, and business interest in Chicago for a long time. And so that's been really important for me for a number of reasons. One is that there's something about the culture that takes place in those neighborhoods that is satisfying. And it's satisfying on more levels than just the level of entertainment. There's something about the way that people occupy the space, the way that people talk, the way that people move around, all the kinds of things that people do. I always thought it was really important for people in the neighborhood, especially for kids in the neighborhood, to know that there were people on their block, that there were people who they were living next door to who were doing things. And so I wanted to be one of those people who was in the neighborhood who kids could look at and say, yes, that guy is the guy. He does this. He does that. You know, I used to have there were a number of teenagers who lived in the house next door to us, you know, and of course I did what senior citizens in the neighborhood, and I this was even before I became a senior citizen, I have to say, but do what the elders in the community do. So you engage with the young people who live next to you, and you introduce them to things. So you start out by having them come and help you do things. You know, you have them help you cut your grass. You have them help you shovel your snow. I had one of the kids next door help me take down my front porch because I was going to rebuild the steps. I did portraits of them, and then I took them to the Art Institute, I took them to the Renaissance Society. You take them to places so they can see things that nobody else in the neighborhood might be wanting to take them to. And that can only happen if there's somebody in the neighborhood who feels like they're not only a part of it, but they're invested in it.
Right.
And so to the degree that all those places that I lived had been the kind of centers of kind of black cultural dynamics, that's helped to make me understand the value of having a wide variety of people at different social status, at different economic status, different occupations, to have all those people in the neighborhood so that they're available for young people to be engaged with from time to time. I mean, it's just the life. That's the life of the city. That's the life of a community.
It's amazing to hear you talk that way, especially someone who's I've interacted with your work, seen your stuff, and to hear you say that, it makes total sense to what we see on the canvas, the portraits, the stuff that's in the museums. When we talk about the museums, you have been a superstar as of late. The MCA piece that was last year was a huge piece that spanning over 35 years of your work. Mm-hmm. Do you like that kind of thing? Do you like being in the spotlight where it's the Kerry James Marshall retrospective, if you will, and you see the early work and you see the latest work? I mean, is that a goal for you as an artist, or is that something that just comes with the territory?
Well, I mean, it doesn't just come with the territory. It has to be something I think it has to be sought after. And my ambition had always been to be in places like the MCA, to be in places like the Art Institute of Chicago, to be at the Museum of Modern Art, to be at the Met. I mean, that's what I always aspired to do.
Really?
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's we're in a town where the sports team we've been lucky enough to have several sports teams that have been really powerhouses. So the Bulls, right. When the Bulls started winning championships, everybody was invested in the Bulls. When the Bears in '85 won the Super Bowl, everybody was a Bears fan.
Right.
Now the Cubs won the World Series last year. Everybody thinks the Cubs need to win the World Series every year from here on out. So I mean that. The aspirations, it's like, yeah, people like going to Wrigley Field for Cubs games, but they like it more now that the Cubs have won the World Series. So being at the Museum of Modern Art, being at the MCA, being at the Art Institute of Chicago, that's the World Series.
That's the World Series.
Is the World Series. It's being at that level. I mean, if you never reach that level, then you will always have doubts about whether you were good enough to be there. And so to have arrived at that place, to get into those spaces, to have work in those collections. I mean, that really is like winning the Super Bowl. It's like winning the World Series.
Well, what if that's so, winning the Super Bowl and the World Series, what does it mean for you to have a huge mural down on the side of the Cultural Center building? Because it takes a certain person to go into the Art Institute and another person to go into the MCA and respect your work. But to be part of the fabric of what people are going to walk by when they're coming back from work or going to Millennium Park or tourists that are coming downtown to walk around and have a chance to see the work that you're putting up on the wall on the side of the Cultural Center building. What does that mean to you as a Chicagoan, 30-plus years here? What does it mean to have your work be the part of just the landscape that is downtown Chicago?
In a way, it brings the story full circle. I mean, literally. I mean, because the very first exhibition I had in Chicago was at the Cultural Center. And you could say that exhibition literally launched my career so that it was able to get to the level that it has today, so that I end up at the MCA with a major retrospective exhibition. Some of the paintings that were in the MCA exhibition were in that show.
That's awesome.
At the Cultural Center.
Right, right.
And so, I mean, it
all comes together.
It all comes together. I mean, it's fitting in some way that the work ends up being a work that's done for the Cultural Center as opposed to some other place in the city, because the Cultural Center was the place that really, you could say, it made me.
If it were me, I would be standing in front of that mural all winter long being like, would you like to see it? What are you going to do after it's up and it's out there? You're just going to be like, never go back over that
area? Well, but you know, the thing is, you make, there are more things I'm going to want to do than I'm going to have time to do. So it'll be exciting for me to see it finished, to see it done. And then to evaluate and to see whether it meets my expectations, whether it matches the way it worked for me in the drawing that I made for the design. So, I mean, the challenge is always that once you put it up on, it's like from a 33-inch drawing to a 130-foot painting, well, some transformations take place.
Yeah, right.
And there's some negotiations and some modifications that have to be made. And so the challenge, so now just to see whether it actually translates to that scale is actually going to be an exciting thing. And so I'll be looking forward to seeing it done for that. And I'll come by from time to time.
From time to time.
But the thing is, the other thing that's been really satisfying about this project is that some of the people, so I didn't tell anybody that's in the mural that I was going to put them in the mural. But I've heard from some of them.
They're like, hey, I just saw a list with my name on it.
Right, they heard about it.
Right, right.
When everybody else heard about it. And for the meaningful thing is to know that somebody regarded what you were doing well enough to include you in something that honors people who are productive without you having to ask for a chance to be in it. I mean, to know that you're being recognized, that somebody notices mm-hmm. what you do and that they think what you did was important enough.
Okay. Making the invisible visible. Kerry James Marshall, the Chicago artist, has been commissioned to create a 132-foot mural on the side of the Cultural Center building for the Year of Public Art with the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. The longtime Chicago artist has worked at the Art Institute, MCA, all over town. He has just been such a prolific artist, and Chicago thanks you for that. And I thank you for being my guest tonight at the big table. Kerry James Marshall, thanks.
Thanks.
Kerry James Marshall, go down there and walk. Jeff Zimmerman, this is great. You know, he was on not too long ago, muralist here in town. We talked about his work. He is one of the guys, if not the guy, who's doing the mural. Like, because you heard Kerry talk about the idea that he designs it and puts it all together, but the actual painting of it, it's almost done. Like, I've been watching him on Instagram and watching the faces being put up. Different forms. Looks, I mean, it's huge. It's huge. It's a whole side of the Cultural Center building.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
That's so cool. And he was great, man. What a great artist.
Tremendous.
It's good to hear him here on WGN. And he said he doesn't really like doing interviews. I was like, well, you're good at it, man.
Yeah. that MCA exhibit last year or whatever, 2 years ago,
Mastery,
whenever it was. Yeah, Mastery, yeah. Oh, my God, it was great.
Always good to have some serious talent like Kerry James Marshall in the studio. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Herb Alpert, the jazz pop. Sorry, I mean, you want to call him jazz because it kind of fits in the category in history, but he was a pop star. I mean, Herb Alpert and Tijuana Brass was 60s mainstay. I made the point earlier where reading some of the research for it, he outsold and outcharted the Beatles. Like I said, it wasn't early. This is an early one you don't remember. With four mop tops from Liverpool. No, this is like the height
the
of
hits.
The Beatles. All the hits. And they were, because of the time, Herb Alpert and that record, the Tijuana Brass, the whipped.
Yeah.
All the game show music.
Right. Yeah.
And then I didn't know, and I'm excited to talk to him coming up here, but the I didn't know he was the a record executive as well. Big time. He took that all of that, and he turned it into, I forgot what record, A&M Records, but...
Yeah, the A of A&M.
Yeah. It's amazing to think that, I mean, he was able to have essentially 2-3 careers spanning in his lifetime. He's going to be at City Winery coming up here. Awesome, right?
And a Christmas record.
He's got a Christmas record coming out. Also, coming up tonight, we're going to talk about DNA Info and Chicagoist right here after the news. As you may or may not be aware, DNA Info and Chicagoist, the parent company Gothamist, which is owned by DNA Info and Joe Ricketts, the billionaire who – millionaire. I think Rob called him a millionaire. We get so loose. Millions, billions, what do you know? He shut down, surprisingly, shocking today – shut down DNA Info and Gothamist, and those sites are no longer, essentially ending jobs for 150, I think it was 150, 120 journalists in the country, including right here in Chicago, a slew of great people, a lot of which have been on this program.
Yeah.
I think of all the reporters we've had on and all the people who, even, you know, who work behind the scenes and have come on and reloaded the news or talked to us about different things. I, for one, have been a longtime reader and consumer of Chicago's. I always loved their sound, their voice.
Yep.
Their great site, Chicagoist.com, and it's kind of shocking to be broadcasting tonight without that site around. So we'll talk with Scott Smith, who worked for Chicagoist. Back in the day, he had has a long history with that site. Our new media contributor will talk about what it means. obviously the whys and all of the who, what, when, where's, but really about what this truly means for local news, digital sites. Because you can make an argument that this is just one more domino to fall in the experiment of trying to create independent and alternative news sources, not just the two big newspapers, other places, you know, tried over time to create these sites, and for this reason or another, they become economically unviable. And so they fold. And this is a huge one. And the question is, I mean, are there any other entrepreneurs or moguls that are looking towards the media landscape in this country to say that's where I want to invest? Because it feels like they're not. I mean, there's a little bit of gloom and doom when it comes to what this means for media companies in this country. So we'll talk about that with Scott Smith coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, as we've been talking about all night tonight. Today, shocking news that DNA Info and Gothamist, the parent company for the site Chicagoist here in Chicago, put up a letter on the site saying that they were folding. Joe Ricketts, the millionaire owner, said that the business was unsustainable and determined that there was not enough money left to continue the business. So DNA Info, DNA Info Chicago, Gothamist, Chicagoist, they're out. The journalists involved, of course, hundreds, have a severance through February, I think you said, Pete. It's February 2nd or something like that. It's such a tough story, and there's so many friends and colleagues and people that you respect that have worked at both publications here in town, and it really is to see the outpouring of love and affection for that work on social media has been heartwarming, but to say the least, you know, it's bittersweet. On the line with us, Scott Smith. He's he's our new media contributor and a one-time writer and contributor to the Chicagoist site. Scott, great to talk to you on such a sour occasion.
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, as you said, I was a writer there. I was one of the very early folks between 2004 and 2007. And I met my wife there. So, I mean, I owe a career and a pretty great marriage and a great kid to it. So it's tough for me. And I was, frankly, somebody who, with all the community work that I do, was often pitching stories to DNA Info. So, you know, seeing the loss of some original reporting on the neighborhood level is just really stunning.
We'll talk about the hyper-local and the local reaction, but also the impact on the media landscape. But you know, as I kind of summed it up a little bit, but from the letter and from the readings today, why now? Why Joe Ricketts pull the plug on DNA?
Yeah, I mean, this was November is the fifth anniversary, or would have been the fifth anniversary, of DNA Info Chicago. The New York site started in 2009. So, you know, this wouldn't have been news that the model that they were currently pursuing, the way that they were pursuing it, was not exactly bringing in the kind of revenue they were looking for. But a week ago, the New York City office unionized, and the folks that were running DNA Info were making veiled and maybe not so veiled threats that if there was unionizing going on in their shop, then they weren't sure if the business was going to continue to be viable. Now, keep in mind, there's nothing that has occurred at this point that would have changed any of the financials around DNA Info. So the only thing that's changed in the last 8 years of New York and in the last 5 years of Chicago has been the unionizing in the New York office.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about DNA Info, talk about their impact. I mean, we'll talk about Chicago's as well, but let's first talk about DNA Info. DNA Info Chicago, as you mentioned, 5 years this November. Talk about the impact of a site coming into Chicago and reporting on neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not only just the work that they were doing, but at the time they were doing it. I mean, I can't speak maybe as much to some of their other cities like San Francisco, but, you know, definitely in Chicago, you saw the Tribune and the Sun-Times doing less and less of the neighborhood level local reporting that they had done in the past. And DNA Info really filled that hole. And they did it in a digital only news shop. They did have a print product that they developed later, but started off and were largely on a digital platform. And they not only published there, but they were doing a lot of work in finding stories in local Facebook groups and, you know, looking at, you know, local blogs and things like that. So they were doing a sort of digital street level reporting that a lot of folks just had not been doing. And there were only really a couple of blogs, and they were blogs like Chicagoist and Gaper's Block here in Chicago. Gaper's Block also, you know, famously, you know, closed up shop not too long ago. So, you know, DNA came along after, you know, sites like Chicagoist and Gaper's Block had been doing it for, you know, 5 or 6 years. It's important to remember, you know, Gawker was 2002. Gothamist, the network of city blogs, started in 2003 along with Gaper's Block, and then Chicagoist in 2004. So these folks were around, you know, for a significant amount of time before DNA Info, but they were all kind of cut from the same cloth. You know, I think the IST networks got more into aggregation in these later years, but, you know, DNA Info really kind of picked up and ran with it and did the kind of original reporting that the IST networks were doing in their earlier days. And, you know, the IST networks were really doing a lot of the kind of media commentary and alternative news work that a lot of the alt weeklies did. And obviously this has been a time when alt weeklies have been in decline as well. So DNA Info, you know, in particular was, you know, filling that local news hole quite a bit, you know, and the IST networks were really doing a lot. I would say particularly around food and around culture is where Chicagoist in particular did its best original reporting.
You know, having a parent company out of a different town, New York, in this case, DNA Info and Gothamist, talk about, because you and I have talked about the sustainability and viability of these sites. How were they able to translate the hits and the eyeballs into revenue, especially when, you know, you're talking about companies that are in different cities? How what was their model to, was it just straight up putting ads on the site?
Right. I mean, that's largely what their model was. I mean, they were doing some maybe what they call, you know, the native advertising kind of stuff, but it was really an ad and mostly display ad driven model. And what they had improved upon that the sort of early hyperlocal sites had as a sort of black mark against them was, you know, the hyperlocal sites were maybe only delivering a portion of the city, whereas Chicagoist and the DNA Infos, because they were reporting all over the city, they're able to deliver the whole city. And then when you've got a network of sites like DNA Info is developing, like Gothamist, and it's worth, you know, remembering that this, you know, purchase went through just not too long ago, just a couple years ago. And so DNA Info was really trying to say, we're going to get our arms around all of the digital ad revenue that's possible inside a city from people who are younger, who are interested in what's happening in their neighborhood. So they were trying to kind of pull all of that digital revenue together, which is what hyperlocals had traditionally not been able to do. But unfortunately, you know, the economics of things are making it not possible to just run a site on ad revenue. You're going to need multiple streams, and honestly, local reporting is going to be financed by subscriptions going forward. It's just, you know, we've seen the bigger ones like the New York Times are now at a point where subscription revenue is outpacing their digital ad revenue. And I think we're going to see a lot of the smaller folks go in that same direction. The problem is we're getting to a point where there's a lot of big folks like the New York Times, and there's a lot of small neighborhood papers. But there are not a lot of folks in the middle, and it's those middle ground folks, and this is exactly what happened here, that are getting taken out of the game.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back, and I want to ask the question about Chicago. I want to talk a little bit more about Chicagoist, but also about what happened today and what this does, and what does this say to the media landscape? What's it say to investors and to entrepreneurs about getting into the business of startups and digital news sites? Scott Smith, our new media contributor here in The Download, also the director of editorial content at Teamworks Media. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll start talking those questions. Scott Smith on the line. He is the director of editorial content at Teamworks Media, also our new media contributor. We're talking about the story today where DNA Info and Chicagoist here in town shut down the end of the two great local sites here in Chicago covering the news. Let's talk about Chicago, Scott. You know, as you mentioned, you were there 2004. I've always loved that site, and I want to start talking about what it provided Chicago, because I also wonder if the Gothamists and the Chicagoists, if this is sort of the end of an era of the curatorial sites that are almost rewriting the news or telling us what to look at, and you know that, like, the a lot of what, you know, we wanted from the internet early in the days, and it seems like those sites are going away.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, you know, the early days of the sort of, you know, commentary about the media internet. Gawker starts in 2002, Gothamist starts in 2003, you know, Chicagoist starts in 2004. You know, back at that time, it seems crazy now, but there were not a lot of websites who were taking the news of the day and putting it through a different filter. It was still very straight news. You know, you had some blogs, but they were mostly, you know, kind of approaching things still with that sort of news and reportorial idea. You know, the idea that you would, you know, kind of cast a gimlet eye at the news and make fun of it a little bit and have a voice with it, that was not happening at that point, other than these few early sites. And now we see that kind of all over. You know, it is not unusual to find that, you know, the whole hot takes genre is sort of used and abused. And, you know, back at that point, you know, people kind of took this with a fair amount of seriousness. You know, there weren't a lot of folks that were kind of saying, like, look, there are audiences that you're ignoring. There are points of view that you're ignoring. And that's why the IS sites and blogs like that were really, really important. You know, now that's all over the place. You know, it's even sort of baked into more traditional news at this point. And there are plenty of, you know, venture capitalists who are contributing to sites who are doing, you know, things that are similar. And I think a lot of the aggregation that those sites did in the early days, that's now become less important, because we are now viewing most of our news through the filter of Google and the filter of Facebook and the filter of Twitter. And so we've already kind of curated and aggregated the news that we're looking for. And so you're actually finding all of that through now the people that you are friends with on social networks. And so it's hard for sites to kind of come up with a new way of doing that. So, yeah, there is, you know, some level of, you know, what is the hole that's left to fill. And we're now back to a place where there are a lot of, because of a lot of the mainstream and larger news organizations are reducing the number of people who work there. We are back at a point now where it's, you know, like the alt weeklies of old, where the stories that aren't being told are those smaller stories. You know, those are the, you know, malfeasance on the part of township boards or school boards and things like that, that need to be told. And, you know, I was just thinking there was a DNA story today about a, you know, principal who was sort of abusing her authority and all of the community work that went on to kind of band together and end up, you know, getting this principal out of office. I mean, that's the bread and butter story that a DNA Info or that a IS site would jump on very, very early and might eventually get picked up by some of the dailies. And that's the other thing, is that this sort of news ecosystem that used to exist, where a story would kind of bubble up from blogs or some of these, you know, sort of more corporate blogs like the IS sites, and then eventually would end up in, you know, your kind of daily newspapers, or even, you know, a career path for a journalist. You know,
I was going to say, for a lot of young voices, people to craft their voice. And Chicagoists in general, I mean, with you and others, I mean, you guys were able to, and to be able to write up a story, to editorialize a story in a good way, to put voice to a story, to, I think of a lot of the arts and culture stuff that Jim was doing, other people, where you just got this vibe that there was passionate people behind these words, and it meant something that they were writing about the issues they were writing about.
When Chicagoist was first getting started, you know, this is right when, you know, Pitchfork started doing a music festival here. This is when Lollapalooza came back. And so, you know, we were doing a lot of that festival coverage. And now it's, again, it's everybody's doing it. It's all over the place. It's huge. You know, but this was stuff where you could really stand out in your coverage of cultural things. And, you know, I think about Red Eye has reduced its frequency. Time Out has reduced its frequency. Huffington Post Chicago doesn't exist anymore. DNA is gone. Like, there's a damage to the way in which stories develop and bubble up and get reported. And it's not just about the number of reporters, but it is the way in which you could kind of go deep if you were on some of these kind of smaller places and you could get really focused, which would, and, you know, frankly, you had beat reporters who knew the players and knew why something stunk.
Let me ask you, Scott, this,
that's what we're losing.
Yeah.
Now.
But and that's really the point here in this way that do you see it as an opportunity where, okay, all these different sites you just mentioned, it's amazing to think about the wreckage of what was a very healthy online ecosystem here in Chicago when it came to local media, the sites that you just mentioned that aren't around. And it was only 10 years ago that people were having conferences at hotels going, this is the future of media, yeah. And these sites aren't here. And you've been involved with Touch Vision and other places. Is it an opportunity or is it the end?
You know, I still think it's going to require a level of engagement on the audience side that is not the kind of thing that, you know, a venture capitalist firm or the average investor is going to put their money into. Because, first of all, it takes a fair amount of money and it takes a fair amount of time. And it's going to and frankly, at this point, you know, you're going to see a lot more unionization of newsrooms. I mean, that's going to as things get worse, you're going to start to see more of that. But it's really going to be about like being in these communities and thinking of yourself less as a newspaper where you decide or editors decide what the news is, and more about thinking what is a need that has gone unfilled in the community, and actually working with community members and partnering with communities to actually report on news and actually be embedded in these communities, and frankly, in ways that DNA Info certainly was. But it's also going to involve, you know, developing audience data and developing events. And it's not just going to be about kind of hooking yourself up to a Google ad network and waiting for the money to pour in.
Yeah, and that seems to be what the mistakes that have been made has been, we're going to do this, it's going to be great, we're going to invest in local journalism, and the money's just going to roll in. And the money doesn't roll in because it's an antiquated system when it comes to digital advertising. Many, many companies have already sniffed that out and been like, we're not paying for it. The big sort of sponsorship opportunities haven't been there. And frankly, at the end of the day, the eyeballs haven't been there in any sort of, like you just mentioned, any sort of engaged way that is actually going to move the needle. So the question is this reading in the tea leaves to say, okay, well, maybe there's just not an appetite. Maybe the consumers in Chicago are okay with the 10 o'clock news and a couple of newspapers, and they don't necessarily desire anything more.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's too easy to look at some of these. Here's the biggest thing is that what we've gotten away from is the stuff that was really interesting about the IS sites when they first started and what was really great about the All Weeklies. And we've gotten to a point where a lot of digital news becomes whatever your 250-word version is of the same story that everybody else is posting about. And that just, you know, again, that was something that, you know, the Chicagoists of the world and, you know, it kind of came up on. And you know, because the voice seemed unique at the time, you could skate on that. And you could actually do a pretty interesting write-up on that. But now everybody's doing that. And so you have to distinguish yourself with some original reporting. You have to distinguish yourself with the smaller niche stories. And those are harder to report on because they just take more time. And they involve really being close to your audience and knowing who your audience is. So all of these platforms that have gotten in between the publisher and the audience, they are not where you are going to find the revenue if you are a small to medium-sized publisher. Yeah. You're really going to be having to develop your own audiences. You're going to be really tight with the community and figuring out what's going to service them the most. And from all the commentary from people that I've seen online tonight, it's very clear people are like, look, I would give $10 a month if this meant DNA Info Chicago hung around for a little bit longer. Right. So there are folks who are interested in and dying to pay for news now at this point, And I think you're going to start to see the model change where people are saying, okay, if we're going to stick around, but it's going to cost you.
Yeah.
And I hope people kind of understand that at this point.
Scott Smith is the Download's new media contributor, a former writer and contributor to the site Chicagoist. DNA Info and Chicagoist no more tonight as Joe Ricketts pulled the plug on the parent companies DNA Info and Gothamist in New York. They will be paid, the journalists, through February. Scott Smith is also the director of editorial content at Teamworks Media here in town. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you, Justin.
Mary says, that hopefully we'll continue to showcase some of the DNA folks because they are valuable resources to the community. 630 says, wow, that's a big blank blank to the idiots that joined the union. They deserve to lose their jobs. That's a hard one for me because I don't know the economics behind or the finances behind DNA Info. But I don't know any journalists that worked at DNA Info Chicago or any other alt publications. The Reader was a big thing when they unionized here, that are making loot. They're not making money. They're doing it as a job, a lot of times entry-level pay. And I can understand that if you're in a situation where you're worried about job security, but at the same time you're not getting enough, especially if you work in New York, it's not surprising. I'm surprised that it took that long. And I mean, it's amazing to me that that has been cited as one of the factors. Jeez. So the idea that, like, well, you want to unionize? Well, I'll just shut it down. One of the issues as well is having benefactors, one or two benefactors who own the entire company as opposed to a board or diverse investors. Because if it goes against, allegedly goes against the politics of somebody, that could play into a factor of saying, I don't want to do this pet project anymore.
Well, you figure Ricketts has a lot of other wealthy friends.
Right.
My question to him would be, I guess I understand the business aspect of it, but if you were really that passionate about it, couldn't you have gotten some of your pals involved?
Yeah, I agree. Or try to explore building other revenue options. I mean, there probably are, especially as DNA Info continued to grow. There's a lot of questions, too. I love local journalism so much, I couldn't make it work, though. But my new polo, my polo league's going to be great. Such great horses.
Come down.
Yeah, come on down.
You can help us tamp down the divots.
All right, coming up, Herb Alpert's going to join us, the longtime jazz pop sensation, Tijuana Brass, coming to the City Winery. How cool is that? That's coming up here on the Download tonight. Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest is a music legend. One of the most recognizable trumpets in the world. Of course, I'm talking about Herb Alpert. Herb Alpert is considered to be one of the biggest instrumental performers in music history. Alpert started out playing at a young age, wrote songs for Sam Cooke and others, and came of age in the 60s when his work with the Tijuana Brass outsold and outcharted the Beatles. Amazing! At that time, Alpert also began his career as a record executive. He was the co-founder of A&M Records, which introduced us to a number of huge artists, including Cat Stevens, The Police, and Janet Jackson. He ended up selling the label back in 1990 for millions. Alpert continues to put out album after album, and his latest is called Herb Alpert Music Volume 1. And when you listen to it, you realize that Herb Alpert hasn't skipped a beat. He's coming to town at City Winery on November 6th and 7th. And also it was announced that Alpert's sculptures, the 12 spirit totem sculptures that you see when you walk into the Field Museum, well, they were temporary, but now they will be permanently displayed. What can't Herb Alpert do? He's my guest tonight on the Download. Mr. Alpert, it's a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
I can't make peace. I'd like to be able to do that.
You know, listening to the music today and listening to the album, Volume 1, it really does harken back to some of your work and trumpet work and all the stuff that we know you so well. Is that the idea when you create new music like Volume 1 that you really want to stay in the same lane that you've created for all these years?
I try to make music that's interesting to play. You know, I feel like if it's fun for me to play, it's going to be fun for a certain amount of people to listen to. Mm-hmm. And I just keep doing it. I'm passionate about it. You know, I started playing when I was 8 years old, and I had this amazing opportunity in my grammar school. There was a music appreciation class, and there was a table filled with instruments. I picked up the trumpet, and the trumpet was talking for me because I'm very shy. You know, I'm an introvert. And this trumpet was talking for me at a very early age and became very good friends with it, and it's obviously changed my life.
You know, you got your start in the music industry writing for other artists. I mentioned Sam Cooke. But talk about that experience and how that shaped your world and helped you become the artist that you are.
Well, Sam was an amazing artist to watch. You know, he came out of the gospel field. He was a lead singer with the Soul Stirrers, and then when Lou Adler and I joined Keen Records, Sam already had that record, the big record of You Send Me. And then from that point on, we were just watching him in the studio. You know, he was kind of a mentor to me, but he didn't think about that at all. He was so sincere about what he was singing and how he was writing. And I learned great lessons from him. I mean, one in particular was, you know, he used to walk around with a notebook and filled with lyrics. And one day he came up to me and he said, "Herbie, what do you think of this lyric?" Well, I was looking at it, and I didn't say this to him, but, man, I was thinking about it. It was the corniest lyric I've ever seen. That's what I was thinking, you know. And I said, "Well, what does it sound like? What's the song? How does it go? Can you pick up your guitar and play it?" So he picked up his guitar, started singing this song, and holy moly, the song turned into, it was like another, I loved it. I mean, it with his passion, with his, you know, way of putting notes together with the chords he was using and the feeling, it just transformed this thing that I thought was super corny into something that was brilliant. And from that point on, I just realized it ain't what you do, it's the way how you do it. And that's what I was pursuing, because I found myself trying to emulate my favorite musicians like Louis Armstrong and Harry James and Miles Davis. And I could play a little bit like them, but then I got the aha. Who wants to hear that? They've already done it. So I was looking for my own voice, and I found my own voice. And then when Miles Davis said, "You hear three notes and you know it's Herb Alpert," I knew I arrived with that voice.
Wow, that's amazing. I can even imagine as a trumpet player to have that kind of accolade thrown on you. All right, so Tijuana Brass, what a tremendous, iconic music. There's not a person in the world that doesn't know that music. At the time when you were going through it and you were having such success, and you've talked about how you created that sound, which is so impressive, and it wasn't just a straight listening to mariachi bands. There was a lot that you put into the recording and the presence of the trumpet in that music. But when you recorded it and you put it out and it started to be successful, at what point did you recognize this is bigger than I ever thought it could be?
Yeah, we were just putting out one record. We weren't really starting A&M Records. We were starting to put out one particular side to see what would happen, because there were a lot of little record companies at that time, 1962, record companies operating out of the trunks of their car. So when this record happened and it took off like a rocket ship, we had a challenge to see if we could hang on to it, because our distributors that my brilliant partner Jerry Moss put together, they said, "Hey, why don't you guys just take the money and run? You guys got lucky with this thing because you're close to Tijuana and blah blah blah, you know." And that really sparked us, and they wanted a the Lonely Bull album, so we gave them that. And then I got a letter from a lady in Germany while this record was in top 10 in the country, and the letter said, "Dear Mr. Alpert, thank you for sending me on this vicarious trip to Tijuana." You know, and I chuckled when I read it, and then I said, "Holy moly, this record was so visual to her. It transported her." And I said, "That's the type of music I want to make. I want to make music that takes you someplace." Yeah. Well, that takes me someplace, and it takes the listener someplace.
Yeah, it's so interesting, too, because you mentioned that, the visual part of the music. It really does. Your music takes you to a place or to a feel. It's funny because a lot of your work, I think of the, even the visual work that's on the records and the albums, I mean, are iconic. The whipped cream or the album covers and everything in between. Visual is a big part of your music. It defines Herb Albert and Tijuana Brass.
I'm honest about what I'm doing. I'm basically a jazz musician, and I like that spontaneity. I like, well, I think the arts, whether it be painting, sculpting, acting, writing poetry, dancing, making music, it's all about feel. You have to have the feel. You have to be honest about what you're doing. It has to project an honesty that it goes beyond the record. It travels, and I think that's the key. So, but along with that, it's all about timing. You know, if you're at the right place at the right time and you're prepared, things can happen. If we tried to start A&M Records in today's environment, it would not have happened at all. So I got lucky. I got lucky with the timing. I was ready. We had the right song. And then instead of, you know, when we wanted to hang on to the Tijuana Brass sound and the record company, I could have played this Tijuana Brass Lonely Bull sideways and upside down and, you know, try to capitalize on that, but I didn't. I tried to see how far I could take that sound, and that's what happened. I got inspired and got lucky, and I was inspired by the record sales, and one thing led to another. Here I am.
Herb Albert on the line with us. He's going to be at City Winery on November 6th and 7th. He's got a new album out, Herb Albert Music Volume 1. He's got a Christmas album as well that's coming out, too. We'll talk about that in a second. A&M Records, even with the stuff that you were doing, Tijuana Brass, but even as I mentioned, the artists that you were, you know, that you signed and that you developed, whether it be The Police, Cat Stevens we mentioned, or Janet Jackson, I'm interested because you mentioned the idea that it's all about the feel. Is that what you're looking for? Was that what you were looking for in those bands when you would go and A&M Records started to branch out and do other artists? Is that the primary thing you were looking for when signing an artist?
Absolutely. That was it. And that's what I learned from Sam Cooke. Sam was auditioning this artist because he was the first black artist to have his own label. It's called SAR Records. And he was interviewing an artist that he was excited about. This guy was beautiful to look at, green eyes, and came in with a box, put his foot on the box, and was playing guitar, and I was listening to him. I was in the control room, and Sam was out in the studio with him, and he came into the control room. He says, "What do you think?" I said, "Man, I think the guy's great. He's beautiful. He writes nice music." He says, "Do me a favor. Turn your back on him for 5 minutes and tell me what you think." I turned my back on him, and I didn't get it. He said, "That's it, man. It's people don't care if you're black or white or what kind of echo chamber you're using it either. It feels good, it makes you feel good, or it doesn't." And so I take this forward to A&M. Whenever I auditioned a group, it was always with my eyes closed. I didn't want to be intimidated by the way somebody looked or the way they could dance or the way they can, you know, present something other than what they sounded like and how it attracted me. And that doesn't mean I was, you know, always right about that. Because I auditioned a lot of groups that I really didn't understand, but I'd always tell them, I says, "Look at man, just because I ain't receiving your message, that doesn't mean you ain't sending anything. It's just that I'm not getting it." So I wanted to be very careful with that because I never wanted to turn anyone off. But it's all about the feel. You know, when I heard that tape of the Carpenters in 1970. I closed my eyes on my couch, listened to this tape, and this voice was like almost like sitting next to me on the couch, and it was Karen. And so I wanted to meet them. I arranged for a meeting, and when I met Karen and Richard Carpenter, I knew that this was a music that was sincerely coming out of them. This was the music they loved to make. It wasn't necessarily my cup of tea, the type of music I would normally gravitate towards, but I understood the feeling that they were coming across with, and that was the thing that attracted me to them. And we tried to, you know, create a record company with artists that had something special, uniquely special to say. And we weren't looking for the beat of the week. We were looking for the, you know, the Cat Stevens of the world and the Stings and the Police and the Quincy Jones and the Janet Jacksons. You know, those people had their own little thing, and they weren't immediate hits. You know, they were just... they had to flag themselves down to that runway, and that was so beautiful the company.
What amazing history. Herb, as you got the new album out, it's doing great. It's topping the contemporary jazz charts on iTunes. You're coming to City Winery. As you continue to be an artist and you continue to produce music, and not just music, mention the sculptures at the Field Museum or any of the other stuff, what are the challenges that are in front of you? You just talk about these stories and you're like, oh, Herb Albertson, everything. What are the things that are next for you as an artist that you still want to contribute to society?
Oh, that's easy. I mean, there's, Dizzy Gillespie was a good friend of mine, and Dizzy used to say about the trumpet, he says, man, the closer I get, the farther it looks. So, I mean, you never get to be where you want as a musician or as a painter or as an artist. You're always looking for that next thing to take it up to the next level, and that's the challenge. That's the fun part of, being an artist. You never arrive, you're always striving, and that's what I love.
Fascinating and completely humbled to talk to Herb Alpert tonight. He is going to be at the City Winery on November 6th and 7th. He's got a new album out right now, Herb Alpert Music Volume 1. He's also got a Christmas album that's coming out. Herb, a pleasure to talk with you. I can't thank you enough for taking some time out to talk with us, and good luck with the shows here in
Chicago. Yeah, Justin, we're looking forward to it. We played at the winery before. I love it, and we happen to be playing there on my wife Lonnie's birthday, November 6th, and obviously most of you folks know that Lonnie's from Chicago, and I love Chicago.
That's great. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. Such great newlywed dating game kind of music there. Herb Alpert is going to be coming up at the City Winery 6th and 7th of November. Great to have him on the show. Coming up, the new web series Low Strung. Both the creators and the actors, the writers, going to be in studio coming up here right after the news. And also a series with a ton of great Chicago music, Lily Kay, Show You Suck, others in there who've been on this program. A lot of the music that I hear, I'm like, ah, I know that. They've been on. So we'll talk with creators coming up here in Low Strung right after the news. And then it's funny because I've been talking to Larry. Larry's one of our longtime listeners, and he reminded me tonight, because we had it on the board, and we should still do it, is that it is Thursday night, and it's been a while since we've had a Thursday night show because of Blackhawks and all the things in between, but usually on Thursday nights we play Never Have I Ever, which is a great segment. It's so exploratory. We learn so much about each other. But it's very simple, Never Have I Ever, and such great things. And Larry, he's already like, I know I'm going to win.
Well, he's got one ready.
He put it in. You ready for it? Larry says, Never Have I Ever Lied during Never Have I Ever. Yeah.
I love Larry's confidence.
I do, and the problem I have with that, Larry, and I love you, but the we don't usually respond well to the self, the meta, the meta
right.
Worst, or the worst is when you're listening to the worst. All right, again, the worst. I never have I ever lied, and never have I
never have I won or Lou Malnati's pizza on the download.
Right.
Yeah.
312-981-7200. If you want to text, Never Have I Ever. You can call as well. We'll do that after 10:30.
I was thinking about this because I recall you a couple of games ago of Never Have I Ever, you said that you have never worn a cowboy hat.
Oh, that's changed.
But that has since changed
it
since your trip
changed,
to Nashville because
yes.
I've seen a picture of you in a cowboy hat.
And I loved it. Mm-hmm. You know, I went down to Nashville and I was right there on Broadway. I was
feeling it.
Hat and boot store. One of the 20 that are in a block radius.
Pete, where is this said photo verification?
I
want
to
see
send it,
Kaufman in his cowboy hat.
It's good. It's a black one, and I look like Richard Petty. Like I don't, you know, with like the, because I had a beard going and
the king.
Yeah, I looked that kind of. I had that vibe going on. It looked good. I came this close to buying it, and it was my wife who was like, "What are you going to do with that?" Is I gonna wear it? I'm gonna wear it to work. And she's like, "You're just gonna wear that everywhere in Chicago?" And I'm like, "Yeah, this is such a good look." And she just gave that, you know, she gave that nondescript, silent reaction that we all know from our spouses, and it was like, she's on to something. This yeah. might not be the best $50 investment. No, it was one of those that was hilarious because the guy came over, great store in Nashville, but he's like, because I got one, we got one for my son. But it was funny because he came over and it was like, one hat is 50, two hats is 40, three hat whole spiel. Like, I was like, by the end of it, if you bought like five hats, they're just, they pay you. I was just like, all right. But there was a whole thing. I'm not a big country music guy. I'm not a big country culture kind of guy. I've always been a Chicago guy, North guy. But I got to say, man, that some of the, like the country shirt mm-hmm. they had, some tassels.
Yeah.
Country hat.
That's a good look.
I'm telling you, man, I could transform.
That's an inexpensive hat. I've been in hat stores and yeah, you pick one up and you see like $400 and like,
no, it's $50. And it wasn't like a it was a black one. I think it was a Jason Aldean. Like he has a line of hats.
Yeah.
If you knew that?
No.
But we're not surprised.
I barely know who Jason Aldean is.
He has, but it's like, you know, it's a tag on it. It's like Aldean, because I guess that's his thing. He wears like a real rugged kind of hat, mm-hmm. cowboy hat, in his performances. And so he has a whole line, like half of the store was a Jason Aldean line. And that's the one I picked up, and I was like, ooh, I like the rugged feel.
Yeah, you like
fits,
Aldean.
It fits my skull. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was going to go with that, get a little tasseled sport coat. One of those cool design T-shirts or button-up shirts.
Yeah, that's your look.
And that could be my winter look here.
Is that like the double breast pocket with the buttons?
Yes.
Yeah. And boots.
Those were expensive. And the boots.
Like the pearl buttons?
The pearl button shirts were over $100. Oof. But the, and the boots too. Yeah, I could do a whole bit. I would slay in Nashville. I'd be walking down there. They'd be like, here comes Kaufman. You want to play bass tonight? I'm like, I'll play bass.
But the problem you run into, Justin, get the boots, then you've got to completely change the wardrobe, and then you got to get the boot-cut jeans.
Yeah.
So, you're out of pocket like a grand at least.
Already I have to turn over the whole wardrobe. And I got to start walking different. There's a lot that goes
It all started with the $50 Jason Aldean hat.
See, that was all in my wife's look. All of that flashed in my eyes. I was like, yes, I get what you're saying. So. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, a new web series is out. It follows two best friends and their escapades around Chicago. It's called Low Strung.
It's been a weird day.
Yeah, it's been a weird day for me, too. I think I'm being haunted by the alt-right. My Tinder date ended up being some Confederate Nazi Trump supporter with horrible fashion sense.
Ew. I hate it when men don't know how to dress.
Low Strung is shot right here in town and written and created by the stars Victoria Lee and Shervin Bain before releasing the series to the public. It was a critic's favorite at festivals, where Victoria took home Best Actress at the Brooklyn Web Fest. The web series also features great local music, including some of the artists we've had on this show. Show You Suck, Lily Kay, Celine Neon, just to name a few. In studio tonight, Victoria Lee and Shervin Bain, the stars, the writers, the creators of Low Strung. Guys, thanks for being here.
Hello.
Thank you
for having us.
So let's talk about this, because it's just out now. Where's this idea come from? Because obviously it's following you two as
you don't necessarily say best friends, but that's the kind of the concept. Talk about behind the scenes summary of Low Strung.
Yeah, I would definitely call us best friends.
Yeah,
we've only known each other for like 3 years now.
But time is an illusion, really. So.
That is very true. So basically, one day we were just kind of like, you know, how friends always joke about like, oh my God, we should totally have a TV show. We'd be so funny. I think one day I was just like, you know what? You guys shouldn't have a TV show, but we definitely should because we're funny.
Right.
So we just started writing stuff down because we liked the ideas that we were coming up with, and we had lived through all these weird experiences throughout our friendship that we thought would look really good on film.
Are you ambitious in that way that you both want to be in Hollywood or you want to be in this profession? Or was it more of the simple idea of like, we are so funny when we're together, let's put this stuff down?
I think it definitely started off as just the idea, and now things are kind of shaping in a way where who knows where it can go. I think Victoria is over here pretty ready for the spotlight.
I want to be famous. I'm ready. I'm ready for my time to shine.
I'm actually learning a lot, and I'm enjoying that part of things as well. So it's hard to say. It's hard to say where
we
want to go.
When you say, let's write some of this stuff down, because really when you talk about a web series, a lot of times improvisation will go into something like this. But talk about that process, the process of writing a script. Are you writing, is this straight up, here's our 15-page script and we're editing and doing things like you would in the industry? Or is this more like, you know what, let's what happens when we get drugs?
A little bit of both.
Essentially.
Yeah, so I mean, our whole first episode is just one giant acid trip, which you've seen. Mm-hmm. And that is based off of a real life experience that we had. So it kind of like sparked the idea for the whole series. But, you know, from that point when we started writing the pilot episode, we would have like actual meetings and get together with another one of our writers and friends, Ruth, who's also in the show as well. And we would sit down and like write out a script and be like, yeah, 10, 15 pages. And it's always changing. Even when we're filming, we're like, oh, let's improvise some stuff.
Nothing set in stone. Everything's continuously moving, especially on set. It seems that how things formulate in our heads and on paper seem great, but when we're right in the action of things, it's not portraying the way we wanted it to. So luckily the writers are on hand to just flip the script.
I think a lot of people who would be listening would say, you know, I have a funny friend, and I've said many a times that I think we should have our own TV show, but it's really in the execution. And I always think about this because there's a lot of people can come up with an idea, but it's not an idea until you actually execute it. Mm-hmm. You guys are able to do that as the web series comes out and on all the people that you have brought into this project to talk about the musicians, talk about the way that the shoot will talk about Chicago. Talk about how hard it was to get the idea of just the two of you saying, oh, we're really funny, we should do something together, to what we see with Low Strung.
I don't know if I would say it was completely difficult. I think a lot of the connections we had made it, the connections we had as well as the people who were just very gung-ho about supporting us made it seem more possible than we would have thought had we not had that support system. I mean, there's definitely a lot of work involved and there's a lot of people involved that keep us on track, but I think approaching it was one of those things where it was like, there's the support, there's the love for it, there's the excitement about it, and it's just an idea right now, and that just kept building until it's where we are now.
Yeah, collaboration was such a huge factor in making this whole thing happen, because, you know, we can come up with a funny idea, but you know, once the switch goes off and I'm like, wait, I know people who can actually help us execute this, because, you know, Chicago has such a tight-knit community of artists, you know, musicians and actors and filmmakers. And it's like, when you know those people, you're really like, you can do anything. Mm-hmm. Anything can happen, so.
It's one thing to have real-life experiences and to stumble through those real-life experiences as real people, as friends, and say, this would be great as part of the web series. And once you get to that point where you have to execute it and there's cameras and there's scripts, and now you're, and I love this part about it, but now you're actually reading the line that you wrote based off the real thing that you experienced. You know what I mean? Like, like it almost gets, becomes 5 or 6 points from where it was when you first thought it
definitely.
Was funny. How do you keep it real? How do you keep it authentic when it has to go through all of those different channels and touch so many different places?
I think you just have to be flexible in the moment when you're filming, because there's some stuff that we wrote down, and then by the time we got to like the table read, we're like, okay, never mind about that. Let's try something else. And then we get to filming and we're like, okay, that's not working anymore. Let's try something else. So it's just adjusting to the moment and what you're feeling, what feels right, what feels funny.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a lot of, like you said, adjusting. I think jumping into things and kind of not being afraid to just do the things that are in your head as well. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that actual life experience of the acid trip was parts in our head. And I think sharing that out loud and writing it down also was part of it.
What I love about it, too, and I thought about, you know, as I watched two of the episodes, the fun part is that the two of you are, you come out of an earnest place where you want to accomplish something, whether it be you want to go to the club or you want to, in the second episode, you're going to be at a party and you're inviting, you know, someone you're interested in to the party. Mm-hmm. As the episode unveils, more and more obstacles coming your way. But what really comes out is the fact that, that you guys are pretty sloppy. And I don't mean that to be the idea
execution
of what you need to get. You need to get to the club. You need to get to your friend. Everything you do to get there stumbles and fumbles. And at the end, you guys are kind of, you know, back on the couch. Talk about the what you're trying to get out of the characters, the relationship between each other. I mean, it almost reminds me of maybe a show like Difficult People or this idea that you guys, the idea that the earnest, you're earnest and you have what you want to accomplish, but your behavior kind of gets in the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of where the title Low Strung came from, because all this insane stuff is happening around us, and then by the end of each episode, we just kind of give up, and we're like, it's fine.
We just accept life for what it is at that point.
Yeah. And we were talking about, like, you know, a lot of black and brown comedies that are out right now, and there's some really great ones out right now, but they kind of always have this, like, heavy, serious undertone to them, and so we kind of wanted to go in a different direction and just do something that, like, is just so off the wall that you don't even really have to think too hard about it. It's just two friends going through life and making all sorts of mistakes and just, like, moving on from it, and that's just kind of it.
The other part of it, too, is that it is, one of the other characters is the city of Chicago. You guys are playing, you live in Chicago. It's fun to watch where you eat and where you go because they're all Chicago. Yeah. And they're not the typical Michigan Avenue kind of stuff. How important is the city of Chicago in what we see in Low Strung?
It's utterly important. I mean, when I moved here, Victoria's one of the first people I met, and building that friendship has been utterly meaningful to me, and jumping on this project has been amazing, and I think paying tribute to that by showcasing the different scenery and the different places that we've hung out and some of those experiences that we've gathered from different parts of the city is very important to come across in the show.
Is it important for you guys to mirror or represent the scene that you hang out in Chicago? Joe Swanberg was on a show talking about Easy, and he's like, I want to show a Chicago that I hang out in. I want to show a Chicago that's not what everybody, it's not Wrigley Field. And was it important for you guys, especially, you know, with the party scenes and all the things, to show a Chicago that you hang out in?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially with one of our guest stars, Lucy Stuhl, who is just a fixture of the Chicago drag community. You know, having her be a part of it, it was just a really huge deal to us, and it's so important for us to, you know, represent all sorts of types of Chicago, I guess.
And Lucy Stuhl is a great representation of what we want to get across in terms of finding those niche parts of Chicago. Lucy Stuhl is a person who embraces who she is and loves absolutely everything about herself and teaches us all to do the same. I call her Mother Hen. A lot of us call her Mother Hen of Chicago. And having her be on the show and helping us represent, you know, a different side of Chicago that not everyone gets to see is very meaningful. And again, thank you, Lucy Stuhl, for
Shout out to Lucy.
For being on the show. The series is called Low Strung, and you can find it now. It's out. It's a web series. How many episodes?
There are 10 episodes, but the first four are available right now.
And what's the end game here? You won the award at the Brooklyn Web Fest. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
As we have this conversation, I'm curious about, is this a calling card? Is it a jumping off point? Oh. Do you see yourself continuing to do this season two, season three, or doing other projects that will showcase your talents?
For sure. This is definitely just one of our stepping stones in taking over the world, essentially.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely season two. It'd be great if it got picked up. That would be amazing. Yeah.
By who? Like by Hollywood? Like HBO?
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah. But not unlike just making the series. You have to execute that, right? You have to, beyond just saying it'd be great if it'd be on TV.
Yeah.
Are you going to go and aggressively seek that out?
Oh, for sure. We're definitely just getting started. I mean, we have a ways to go, a lot of people to talk to, a lot of growth amongst ourselves to keep, you know, having. And I think, like you said, there's a ways to go. There's a lot of different places and opportunities that we can take with this.
Yeah, and it'd be great to solidify our part in the online community first, so that when we do, like, maybe want to pitch it to, you know, a network, a major network, if we could do that one day, we have, like, this huge, you know, background following.
My last question is just about the process. And you guys as friends in real life and also on the show, and the four episodes are out and there's going to be six more. What have you learned from the experience, from season one of shooting all this stuff? How have you evolved as friends, but also as writers? What's the takeaway from the experience of Low Strung?
I've learned to be patient with things, because when we first started writing it, I was like, okay, we're going to get all this mm-hmm. done, and we're going to film it like tomorrow, and then we're going to be famous by Monday, and it'll be great. And I've really learned it is just that. It's a process, it takes a lot of work and a lot of communication with one another, and it takes strong relationships between all of us. So,
and I think I definitely learned that people are amazing in all different shapes, sizes, and colors, and getting to meet all these different people. Like, we're still meeting a lot of different Chicago artists, and I think meeting all these different types of people helps us expand our own mm-hmm. minds and helps us create better characters for the show to showcase across the whole world, hopefully.
I'm looking forward to seeing it on HBO. Maybe Stars.
Maybe Stars.
Maybe Stars, but let's go for that. But in the meantime, you can check it out online. The series is called Low Strung, and it features the work of Victoria Lee and Shervin Bain. They're both the writers, the creators, and the stars. Victoria won the Best Actress at Brooklyn Web Fest, but also it's got great music. We didn't even talk about the music, but it speaks for itself. Whether Lily Kay, Celine Dion, Show You Suck, great music. Congrats to success on this, and we look forward to seeing the rest of season one and beyond. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Download here, 720 WGN. Speaking of Best Chicken, did I tell you, I feel like when I went to Nashville like a week ago for my cousin's wedding, we haven't really had too many shows, so I haven't had a chance to talk to you about it. I went and stood in a 30 to 40 minute line to get some Hattie B's in Nashville, the hot chicken.
Mm-hmm.
But it was funny because there's the one that's in, I think it's, there's one in East Nashville, one in West Nashville. The one that's, like, more hipstery, the one that's, like, kind of like Shaq or the one that everybody knows. Mm-hmm. The line was so long that I was like, oh, I don't know if we have time, blah, blah, blah. And so there was another. There's another one. They opened, like, a more freestanding one a little bit further, like 10 minutes in a different direction. And so we went to that one. And it looked like a McDonald's, essentially, you know. But it was the newer one. Like, so I was standing in a line. I was like, we're standing in a line to, like, go to the Wendy's.
Yeah.
You know, like, I it wasn't as special as if you were standing in, like, line for the original.
For the original one, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're because that one is, like, snake on a side. You snaked around the block on a sidewalk. You get up close, and it's, like, picnic tables.
Oh, yeah. It's, like, it's kind of like, you know, like, oh, yeah, I'll meet you down at the Billy Goat. No, I'm at the one on Madison.
I'm at the one in the merchandise mart.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so anyway, but we got it. It was super funny how long it took, and it was just like to eat the piece of chicken. And I was like, okay. But yeah, it was a fun experience. And I talked about it a little bit when, you know, the wedding was awesome. It was great. But it was classic, like, trying to shove as much Nashville into 2 days as you can.
Yeah.
And we went down.
It's tough.
Well, what happened?
So much to do, and it's a long time to get there. And
it took forever to get there, and I will say, when I went to Nashville proper, because we stayed in Murfreesboro, right? On Friday night, I brought my son with and my dad, and we met up with a cousin, and we were ready to rock, right? My mom. But it's just like, you know, like, we got down there, they might as well, there's just so much traffic. It was Friday night at 8 o'clock or something. It was worse than Chicago. There was so much going on. There was like a parade and a football game and a honky-tonk. And
oh, man.
Everything you could fit into a small two-block downtown was happening. Yeah. So we finally found a place, and I was like, oh, there's a restaurant here. And the restaurant was like an hour and 10 minutes, hour 20 minutes. Wait. And right away, that's what my mom's like, well, you know what? We'll just find a place. I'm like, you know what? Because I was kind of stressing out. I was
like,
all right.
I can feel the stress.
I know.
Yeah.
It's like six or seven people with, and I'm like, all right, I'll take care of this, you know. Let me call my wife back in Chicago. She'll make it happen, right? So anyway, we were walking around. We went down to Broadway, brought my son down there. It's just like, it's just, you know, it's as much of a cluster bomb as it possibly could be.
You should have took the family on one of those pedal taverns.
That's what I was about to say.
Oh, sorry.
No, but it's so funny because we were there, and you know, you I'm there with my 10-year-old, and I'm trying to tell him how cool this is. She's like, you just don't see too many places, right, where every bar has a band playing Sweet Caroline. I thought it was supposed to be country music. Okay, whatever. And then they go back, you know, by, and it's like, woo, this kiss, you know. We're on the bike with 12, like the Navy Pier version of 12 people drinking while there's like they're playing like Faith Hill. Magical. Kiss. He's like, I want to go on one of those. And I'm like, well, yeah, maybe when you get older.
That's hilarious.
So it's like, I'm sure they'd enjoy the pedal power that is needed right now. But at the end of the day, it was funny because it was such a pain in the butt. We ended up finding a place that was just like a chicken place on the strip, like right there. And my dad found it. He's like, hey, look, no wait. Great. It was terrible. It was like, you know, it was like if you went
reason.
To like, yeah, it's like if you went down to somewhere in Chicago and you just were like, I guess we'll eat in this place called, you know, I won't name a, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So it's funny, like the first night I was like so down because I'm like, this is going to, I was so excited. I think I said on the air that I was like, I'm going down to Nashville. It is going to be 3 days full of the best food, the best honky tonk. I get myself a Jason Aldean cowboy hat. None of that stuff happened. Instead, we went past the bar bands that were playing, and they're playing like, they're playing Sweet Caroline and Bye Bye Miss American Pie and stuff. And I'm like, that's not, no. Where's the fiddle? Throw some fiddle on that.
They can fiddle that up, though, can't
fiddle
they?
Fiddle it up. I'm asking you to fiddle it up. How much money do I have to put in the bowl for you to fiddle it up? So it's like that whole day, I was like, yeah.
Get that mandolin working.
Come on.
Yeah.
Just, I know that you probably just played Devil Went Down to Georgia like maybe 10 minutes ago. Once again. Do it again. All right, we'll play Never Have I Ever coming up here. 312-981-7200. We already got some good stuff coming in. All right, let's do this. We'll take a break for the news. Yes, we're playing Never Have I Ever, truncated version here on the download tonight. 312-981-7200. It's a fun little game where we text in and call in the things we've never done. And if it's crazy enough, we'll give you Lou Malnati's pizza. How about that? We've got two of them to give away, so we're going to do that. 312-981-7200. Like I said, I got one of mine crossed off, which was good, which was never have I ever worn a cowboy hat. Not anymore. I did it in a store. I would buy my cowboy hat rugged and looking like it's used. Like I do one of those, you know, like almost like you buy jeans. In the way now we're like, oh, those look worn. Like I'd want to buy a hat that's worn. So the first time I wear it, people are like, this guy wears it all the time. I don't want it to be like fresh, sparkly, and new. I'm not looking for a Waylon Jennings type. I'm looking for more of a Tim McGraw.
I remember in, I don't know if it was high school or college, I wanted a black leather jacket because I thought they looked cool on people.
Right.
And then you get one, and it's brand new.
Yeah.
You can't move.
Here, I'll give you one. Never have I ever owned a leather jacket.
I think I wore it like four times, and I was so embarrassed by like wearing it outside. I don't know. Like I should have like walked on it or, you know.
I think there was a leather jacket explosion, a movement, if you will. During that time, late grade school, high school, and I skipped it because I had somehow decided that I was going to be, you know, I was going to go all alt, and instead I'd be a suede guy.
So there's very nice.
There's like like a air bomber kind of suede jacket that I had. It was really nice. All right, 773. You ready for this one, Kathy? Kathy says, never have I ever played a game on my phone or the computer. Really? You've never played like a solitaire or a Words with Friends or in my case, a Stratego? At one point or another, I don't have it on my phone now, but a phone I had a couple of years ago, I had Risk. You could play Risk on your phone. It was the greatest. Because what's the biggest problem with the game Risk? How long it takes. With all the little pieces, and you got to move it around. It's like a 14-hour game. But the greatest thing about this game was that you could move very fast and you just like double tap and the battle happens. So you're missing out, Kathy. I'm trying to think. I don't have any games on my phone. But I have played games on my phone or computer. Pete, you've played games on your phone.
No.
Never?
No.
Well, never. You've never had a phone where you're like, oh, I'll play solitaire. I'll play it.
Mm-mm.
How about on a computer?
No.
Wow. There
you
go.
Not a game guy.
You're not a game. You're a real fun guy around the holidays. What should we play? Should we play Parcheesi? Nah, you know what? I'm not a game guy.
I'll play like, you know, catchphrase and things like, you know, yeah, right. charades. But
right.
I always, when I get on the train at night, everybody, you know, they get their head locked into a phone.
Yeah,
I'm
right.
thinking, oh, they must be reading up on, you know, history and what happened today with, you know, and in the news. And they're all playing bleep, blop, bloop. You know, I see things dropping.
Crush. All right. I feel like... a lot of, like I said, I play Stratego, classic game. That's a class. It didn't really work on the phone. And I play Risk. Risk is, like, so good on the phone. It's so quick. The worst part about Risk is it takes 28 hours to play. But on your phone, you can play it in, like, 2 minutes.
Yeah, and then you don't have to worry about all the little pieces moving around.
Right.
It's great.
It's classic. All right, let's go to Barbara. Barbara, what have you never done?
Well, I never, ever throw away any political mail that
literature
comes
stuff?
In my mailbox.
Really?
No, I don't. I find that it makes wonderful dustpans. They're just absolutely disposable. And if I have a very nasty mess to clean up, like after a cat or whatever, I take a minute and to choose whose picture I'm going to use.
That must be, I mean, there's got to be a lot that comes to your mailbox around election time, right? It's crazy.
Well, yeah, and I save them. They last from 1 year to the next. There's always an election coming in the spring.
You've got a ton of Al Salvi campaign literature from back in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Thanks, Barbara. That's good. We could do what we do with, like, 80s baseball players, so, like, people who've run for stuff. You got a big Roland Burris. You got a lot of... who's got the Bob Kustra? That's a good one, right? Kustra? What was it? Corinne Wood? Wasn't there a Corinne Wood? Yeah, she ran. She was lieutenant governor, and she ran for lieutenant. I think she either ran for governor or lieutenant governor. I can go deep and state politician. Al Salvi. Oh, the cat. Oh, the cat made a mess again. Can you get the Glenn Pichard? All right. 708. I'm ready to play. I'm Mary or Marie. I can't tell if that's Marie or Mary. Excuse me. And never have I ever been to a Red Lobster. Oh! I don't know what to say about that. I have been to a Red Lobster. I'm not a huge fan, but I will say that the biscuits are all the rage, like the cheddar cheese biscuits at Red Lobster. That's an internet fave. People go out of their way, and I think you can – I've seen it a couple of times where friends have made them from scratch. Like they've got the recipe for what are considered the cheddar biscuits at Red Lobster. Everything else, you know.
Oh, shrimps.
You like the shrimps?
Yeah.
All you can eat shrimps? Red Lobster, you know, in the city, there's the only thing I remember, there was a Red Lobster. They opened up on Dearborn across from the Hard Rock Cafe. And I was living in Bucktown just a couple years ago. And I remember we're like, this is the biggest thing that's ever happened in Chicago. It's right next to the Chili's, too. We got to get down there. So we went and we parked and had a... deliciously mediocre meal, and it came out and the car got towed.
Oh no!
Yeah, like it was like because it was River North, and it was one of those like from 5 to 5:15 on the right side on Tuesdays or Thursdays. You know, I was just like, are you kidding me? So they go let down to the had to go down to the lot and get it.
Whatever, yeah.
But I was just like, so that's my memory of Red Lobster. This is before the meters. You know what I mean? Like this was a.
Yeah.
Data special.
708 says, never have I ever been to a Cubs, Blackhawks, or Bulls game. Huh? Missed out. I went to Blackhawks game last night. You heard the story. Roe was talking about Judy Pilak's birthday was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And she was scheduled to ride the Zamboni. Like at the between the periods, they're going to be like, ladies and gentlemen, Judy Pilak from WGN News. And she was bragging about it. She was hardcore bragging about it.
Yeah.
Like in the box. She's like, well, I would stick around, but I got to go ride the Zamboni. And my son was there. He's like, what? That's cool. And we're like, she's going to be down there. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some people are there because it was in the box. It was upstairs. And,
mm-hmm.
and it was super funny because about maybe 10 minutes later, she's back up there. I'm like, when do you ride the Zamboni? She's like, oh, I went down there and I was too late and they won't let me do it now. I was like, what? She's like, you have to be there at the 11-minute mark. I got there at the 9-minute mark. That was it. Yeah, I was a little bit flabbergasted because I was like, wait a second, who cares? Like, it's only a minute to you're there, but I guess they're sticklers to the time. And it was funny, though. I will say this to the Blackhawks defense. Nothing against Judy. I love Judy. But it was funny that she said, I went down there. I mean, I left here with 13 minutes on the clock to get down there. I'd take the elevator down. It took a while. And her friend that was next, she's like, you left around 11. Like,
oh, yeah. Like, I think it was, not helping out there.
She was not helping out with the story. But the time shift. But, yeah, Judy didn't make it to the
game. Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. Well, next time. Do you get to do that?
I'd have never asked, never tried. It would be fun, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess. I don't know how fun it is to ride the Zamboni.
Probably more fun than having to shoot the puck. I mean, I'd love to shoot the puck, but it's embarrassing.
Who did it last night? Spice Adams. Anthony Adams. They're like, ladies and gentlemen, he played for the Bulls. He played for the Bears. There he is. I'm like, yeah, all right, Anthony.
Nobody cares. Do they still do the women, at the girl, like the sexy girl at the end in tight jeans?
Or
I know they used to play like a strip song, but they got rid of
that. Are you talking about
the
ones that come out and sweep the ice?
No, the three contestants for the shoot the puck. Usually the first one's an oaf, second guy is some other oaf, and then the third is like some hot girl and like
I heard
heels.
A rumor that the women who come out to do the ice, that at one point or another someone complained about the scantily clad outfits.
Oh,
I don't know when this was in Blackhawks lore. Like I said, this is a rumor I've heard. And that someone said this is inappropriate for family or whatever because there was just a lot of it was top heavy.
Yeah.
And so they changed. It's funny because they changed the outfits for now. It's like
hockey
they're covered
equipment.
Up on the top and then they just got short skirts.
Oh.
It just changed.
They moved everything
they
down.
They just flipped. They just moved stuff around. But, you know, now it's a little bit more anatomically correct. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's take a quick break so we're on time tonight, and I'll come back and we'll rapid fire through the ones we got. Pam, stay on the line. I got a bunch of texts. We'll give away some pizzas at the end of this. Stay with us. All right. 312-981-7200. We're playing Never Have I Ever. Why don't we kick it off the second half here with Pam. Pam, what have you never done, Pam?
I have never gambled.
Really?
Never, ever. Uh-uh.
Are you the kind of person who goes into a casino and just watches or just avoid
No,
the casino?
I've never been to one. And the reason is because my father was big on gambling on the horses when I was little. And I always thought, oh, I don't want to get addicted to gambling.
That's how it works, right? Yeah. That's good, though. That's good. I mean, you're not, and I will tell you right now, if that was one thing that you, like, in life, they're like, Pam, there's one thing that you will never be able to do. That's a good one. Because it's just, there's nothing that exciting about it. I mean, if you win big money, you're like, yes, I'm so excited. But that rarely happens. So.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Well, I may still try it before I die, but today's my birthday, so.
Oh, my gosh.
Exciting.
Happy birthday, Pam.
Thank you.
Oh, that's awesome. Thanks for calling
Thank you. Thank
you. There you go. Pam with her birthday. Okay. Awesome. Thank you, Pam. I feel like we have to double check that, fact check that, Pete. You know?
You don't believe the never gambled?
No, the birthday.
Oh.
No, Pam, happy birthday. She's right on, man. I honestly have had a lot of great times gambling, low rent stuff like playing blackjack and things like that with friends at tables. That's awesome. But I don't know. Like, I feel like it's not something that has added any sort of perspective or
any sort of good memory, anything to my life.
But, like, would you consider the playing the lottery gambling? Would you be consider, a, like, a fantasy football league gambling?
Yeah, maybe. I don't consider that. I consider that skill. when I think gambling, I think, like, casinos. But yeah. Maybe you're right. Maybe if I consider fantasy football and baseball and stuff like that gambling, then, yeah, it's probably mm-hmm. a bigger part of my life than I think.
Never put down a square on a Super Bowl?
No. I did one time, and this is how they get you. I was in Vegas one time, 2001, and... Or 2000, and I was we were in early 2001, 2000, and I put money on the Bears to win the NFC Central or North at that time. I think it was Central, mm-hmm. and they won. That was the year that they won with Dick Geron, and they went to the playoffs. And it was a 20-1 or 40-1 odds. It was huge. I put $20 down, so I won like $500 or $600. I think it was $600 or $800 or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, that's feeling good.
And so what I did, classic Justin. Is I just went back to Vegas to get it instead of like you can mail it. And
yeah,
I was like, no, I'll just
$750.
Yeah. So I spent it all to get. I'm like, oh, gee, duh. That's how it works. That's how they get you. And I was like, yeah, I'll go. It'll be fun. The only thing is, I think it was right. It was right after 9/11 that I went in there. So it was like you could stay at the Luxor for like $20.
Oh,
yeah. They were just like, please, somebody come have
fun. Yeah, come so, travel.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Never have I ever, never, ever did I put mustard on a hot dog. What? You got to put mustard on a hot dog. It's so good. 815 says, never have I ever eaten sushi. You got to get over that, man. Try it out. I love sushi. It's one of I feel like I grew up in, you know, Wonder Lake. Sushi wasn't plentiful. It was 80s, 70s, and 80s. So I feel like in the 90s when that craze came on, I was like, man, I don't really know it. And then you get to a point where you're like, I feel totally, totally intimidated by the going in and trying to figure that out. But once I finally was like, I'm going in, I was like, this is great food. I love it. It's good stuff.
That's the worst is never having sushi and marrying somebody who loves sushi. And then she stopped eating sushi. So he gets me into it and waited like 40 years to try
like,
sushi.
This is the greatest stuff. She's like, yeah, but it's really filling. I don't really like it. And you're like, ah.
Now no more sushi.
Oh, that's no good. Never have I ever stopped loving the Sears catalog lingerie section. That's Jerry. Jerry's back. All right. You did that one before, but I see what he's saying. But it may be back. I guess there's an article about how they might be bringing it back. Costco sells the Red Lobster cheddar biscuits mix. There you go. Never have I ever ridden or driven on a motorcycle. Okay. You don't have an uncle who came around and be like, I'll drive you to the end of the block and back. That's my experience with a motorcycle. and 708, never have I ever dug a hole. What do you mean you never dug a hole? I guess if you live in the city and you just, yeah. Yeah, so that's about it. All right, 312-981-7200. We're giving away the Lou Malnati's. What did I just do with it? Here it is. Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. The first one we're going to give to Barbara, right? Don't you think that we should give Barbara? Never have I ever thrown away any of the political flyers because I use them as dustbins.
Yeah, because I got to hear Al Salvi.
Yeah, we got to do totally some bits about it. Al Salvi, so that's worth a pizza. Thank you for that inspiration. And then I want to say that the next one we will do is never have I ever, just for you, Pete, we'll give it to Kathy 773, never have I ever played a game on my phone or computer. What do you think of that? That sound good?
Like it.
All right, there you go. And also, I mean, I feel like I don't have a pizza for you, but I wanted to say once again, happy birthday, Pam. Right? I only had two to give away, and gambling doesn't, we did that one before, but I just wanted to say, Pam, that we're thinking about you on your birthday.